When everyone finds their seat, we'll begin the meeting.
Teacher, I'm in my seat.
That's good. Did you bring treats for everyone today?
Just me.
Oh, Kate did. That's right, yeah. I'll call the meeting to order. The first item on the agenda is the adoption of the consent agenda. You should have that in front of you in your packet behind tab 3. And normally, for new members, the motion would include approval of the December 20th minutes of the minutes of the December 20th, 2017 meeting.
So moved.
There is a motion. Is there a second?
Sorry.
There is a second. Is there further discussion on the motion to approve the agenda and the minutes of the December 20th meeting? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion is carried. We obviously are reconfigured in the boardroom. I think, Will, you had indicated that the possibility that the dais will be at some point removed, and so we'll be able to move this further back to be able to accommodate more. So that is the future approach to streamlining the boardroom to accommodate the expanded size of the board. What I'd like to do is to go around the room and have everyone introduce themselves, and for the benefit of certainly the new members that are here today, and also for the quote-unquote old members to know who you are. So, Tom?
And please make sure you use the...
Well, you know who you are. Oh, and one thing, you need a microphone because we are being videotaped. And so if please pass the mic along and remember to use the mic in terms of any comments that you might have. Tom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom Landwehr, Commissioner of Natural Resources.
Julie Gehring, citizen member for Moorhead in the 7th Congressional District.
Kate Knuth, citizen member in the Twin Cities. I did bring treats. I think I have enough also for meeting attendees. I have 3 boxes of Girl Scout cookies that I would like out of my cupboard, not eaten by me. So
what's the expiration date?
They are fresh from this year. They're not from the freezer. So, but I think we can share them with everyone.
So. Other way.
I have 2 mics here. I don't know if it's on. Shantira Hardy, Commissioner, Department of Employment and Economic Development.
John Sachs-Haug, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Matt Mossman, Commissioner of the State Department of Administration. And just a light humor, we don't need to give Shantara 2 microphones. One will be just enough.
Kristen Ide-Tellison, citizen member from Southeast Minnesota.
Al Forsberg, newbie board member, representing Congressional District Number 1 across Southern Minnesota. And Will had asked that I share a few things about myself, since I am a new member, if there's anyone interested in 70 years of history here. I just turned 70, so that's kind of on my mind these days. On a personal level, I've been married 42 years to a wonderful woman. We have 3 grown children, 3 grandchildren, and that's really the center of my life. On a professional basis, I'm a civil engineer, registered engineer in the state of Minnesota. I worked for a heavy construction contractor early in my career on a dam in Georgia, actually, a hydroelectric pump storage dam. I was a high school physics teacher for 4 years. I worked for the Metropolitan Transit Commission for 3 years. Worked for the Army Corps of Engineers as a water resource planner, small project manager for 6 years. Worked for the County of Wabasha for 3 years as their appointed county engineer. Worked for the county of Blue Earth County, Mankato, for 28 years, and that was certainly the bulk of my career there, a very rewarding, challenging, consuming career. I retired a couple years ago, and I was actually retired for about a year, and then I went to work for Steele County as their interim county engineer, over their construction season this summer, and now I'm working part-time for the county managing construction program. I did apply for the position. I've always been very interested in preserving and enhancing the environment. So that's where I'm coming from. It's a chance to continue to serve as a public servant. And I also have a considerable amount of practical experience from being a county engineer and working with these various agencies. I've worked with consultants and developed an EIS for a large project, wrote a couple EAWs myself, and drew innumerable permits over the years from all the agencies here plus a couple more. So I do have considerable practical experience, and I hope to bring that perspective. My dedication to preserving and enhancing the environment, but also my perspective as an engineer that was out there building things and needing permits.
My name is Brian Murdoch. I'm also a new citizen member. I represent the 8th District. I live up in Wyoming, Minnesota. And the district runs from the southern part of Chisago County all the way to the Canadian border and toward the middle of the state. I live on a little hobby farm with a wonderful wife, Leanne. I've got a couple of kids that are in their mid-20s, so they're fledged and busy. I've been interested in the environmental industry since I started. I started as a chemist in 88 and evolved into an environmental consultant. And my first experience with the Environmental Quality Board or the process was in the early 90s when I represented some small local farmers in western Minnesota, and they wanted to put together a large feedlot, and I thought that would be an interesting and fun project, and at that time it was pretty contentious, and I got to learn what a heated county meeting really looked like as a young professional. So that was my first experience, and so I've had 30 years of working in the environmental industry, a handful of EAWs and environmental review type projects. I've also worked directly for city and state governments, so worked with the MPCA on both Superfund projects and emergency response. So I have a nice perspective working for both project proposers, private industry, and the state government. I hope to bring that to the board, that unique perspective. I think the other part of being part of this board that's really interesting to me is I've worked for larger project proposers and smaller entities, and I think the one thing that I'd love to help with, and by the looks of some emails that were flying around last week, I'll get to make sure, or at least help in making sure, that this process doesn't exceed the resources of smaller entities and small businesses. I want to make sure that the process doesn't preclude them from growing into something more than a small business. And something about me, I guess the analogy would be I'm neither Ford or Chevy. I like to sit in the middle and listen and step off that line once I've heard good information. And I'm all in. I'm excited.
Good afternoon. My name is Jan Malcolm. I am 2 weeks into my role as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. Pleased to be joining this group. My career's been in kind of all over the health system, healthcare delivery and finance and health policy and public health. I guess my main claim to fame is this is my second tour of duty on the EQB and at the State Health Department. I had the privilege of serving once before in the late 90s and early 2000s. And I remember those feedlot discussions from before. So I look forward to learning how things have evolved within the EQB and the issues that we deal with. Happy to be here. Thank you. And I'm sorry to be late. I couldn't for the life of me figure out the parking, but now I know. So I'll be on time.
Good afternoon. I'm Jessica Lumen. I'm the commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I'm relatively new to that position as well. This is my second EQB meeting, but was really excited to be able to be a part of the strategic planning work that EQB is doing. I'm really happy that you brought my favorite cookies. Thanks. Thank you, Kate.
Thanks. I'm Dave Fredrickson. I serve as Commissioner of Agriculture in my day job, and thanks to the governor, I've served as the chair of the EQB for the last 7 years. The structure is the governor appoints the chair. I would serve on the board also as a representing the Department of Agriculture. Your last name is Murdoch, and my home is Murdoch, and so consequently we have great expectations for you, and happy to have you. And Jan, it's great to see you back in the saddle over here again. And Alan, great to have you join us on the board. We have a new expanded board. I'm looking forward to engaging with all of the issues. Feedlot issues are, we used, during those years, we called them the feedlot wars. And I hope we never have to go back to battling those out again. It wasn't really a fun time, certainly. So, Will?
Great. I'll use this one if that's okay.
Sure.
Will Seifert, Executive Director of the Environmental Quality Board. I'm just going to go into my report right now, a number of items, and then I'll turn it over to some colleagues to talk about a training they participated in. You know, the first is it's really exciting to, you know, welcome so many new members to the board, both courtesy of some statutory changes at the legislature this last year with new citizen members as well as some new faces in the cabinet. So, you know, welcome from the staff. I also want to mention we're going to have one other new member that comes on at the end of the year. So the governor has one more appointment to make in October for a member from the 3rd Congressional District. So we'll be looking to advertise that vacancy as we get through the summer here. A couple other changes I just want to point to. First is, as we speak, the governor is having a press conference on the 25 by 25 water engagement process and some recommendations that he's seeking to advance this legislative session. And so in front of you is the final report. So if you haven't seen it already and have an opportunity to look through it, please do so. This report was really compiled by a lot of experts on your team, and it really was improved by the participation of all of you throughout the engagement, and I also want to recognize Katie Pratt for her hard work in trying to pull all this together to get it ready to get released today. So that is going on while we speak, and Commissioner Stein will be back here after it concludes to give a little bit of an update from that conversation. One other change I want to note, since we have so many new faces and there's so much content to try to pass on, what we did was we put together this binder here for everybody. And so just real briefly, if you look at it, if you leave, you're welcome to take it with you. We just ask that you bring it back. But if you look through it, you know, the first tab has just a brief introduction, some procedures, policies, good information for board members. And then we get into, in the second chapter, roles, responsibilities, and authorities, if you want to cross-reference any of that. Throughout the meetings, but also we printed out our rules and our governing statutes to go with that. And then under tab 3 for each meeting, we're going to update the agenda, so you don't need to print off your agenda and bring it with. Just look to tab 3 for the current agenda, tab 4 meeting minutes, and then we go in through the rest of it and cover a little bit of EQB history, some details about the environmental review program, directories for members and staff, as well as some communication and engagement resources. And then for citizen members, we have expense forms in tab 10. So as I said, you're welcome to take this with you, but we just ask you to bring it back. Otherwise, just leave it here, and we'll keep it updated for each board meeting. If you see two here in front of you, is just a real high-level agenda for the March board meeting, just to so you see. This is in Moorhead, and most of you have gotten back to us with RSVPs, but if you haven't, we just ask that you do so as soon as possible and also indicate if you have an interest in carpooling. We want to make sure that we can arrange for some shared transportation if that works. But we just want to recognize Julie for her hard work in helping to co-host this with the Red River Management Board. One note on it, if it will circulate after the meeting, we'll circulate the registration information, but you're going to have to register yourself for these. So for commissioners, we can follow up with your assistants to make sure that they register on your behalf. If you're able to, for citizen members, just want to highlight that. We're going to need you to register yourselves if you are able to. We can't register en masse for everybody. And then the only other thing on my list is I think I'm going to turn it over to Katie Pratt and John Saxhog, who attended a training that the Department of Human Rights put on for all boards and commissions of the state on inclusivity. And so they went and listened on behalf of us, and they're doing a little report out now.
Welcome, Katie.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, board members. John and I were last Monday at a two-hour training hosted by the Office of Civic Engagement in the Department of Human Rights, as well as Nexus Community Partners, which is a kind of civic engagement consulting group. And they put on a really excellent training for government groups as well as non-governmental groups on how to make boards and commissions more inclusive. And so we wanted to just spend a couple minutes giving you some very high-level highlights and reflections from that training. So just really briefly, what does it mean to have an inclusive space or an inclusive board? This is some language they used around sort of what inclusion feels like. Feels like being a representative, you know, feels like you're a valued member of a team. And that's something that we would want for all members who serve on this board, as well as for our larger community of partners and audience members who take part in our activities. And as a reminder, too, this has really been a push of this administration to think about how we can diversify our boards and commissions and make them more inclusive. So the way that they, in the training, were thinking about inclusion was really in these three buckets, and I'll just run through them each very quickly. One is around access, one is around attitudes, and then the third around practices. So in terms of access, it's really creating a welcoming environment, and you can break that down kind of into two areas. One is around some of the logistics of how you set up your board activities, everything from ADA accommodations, make sure that you're inclusive of anybody who wants to take part, as well as when and where your meetings are, those types of logistics. So that was one area. And then access is also about who has access to serve on your board. How do you recruit people? What kind of networks do you use to recruit folks to your board? And as Will said, we'll be having another appointment at the end of the year. So that's something we can really think about is what is our procedure for recruiting board members, and how do we make that as accessible as possible? So attitudes is basically your culture that you have on the board. And in the training, they reminded us that culture is both sort of the visible rules that you use to operate, things like perhaps Robert rules is a mechanism that we use to operate. But it's also sort of the hidden norms of the way that you work together. And so I think that's something we can continue to discuss is what kind of group culture do we create on this board? And then finally, the third area is around governance. What kind of practices do you use to get board work done and our mission accomplished? And there's a lot of things that go into practices. And again, I'm taking just sort of some snippets from a much longer training. But they're talking about how you use your agenda to really create an inclusive space. How do you work discussions into your agenda so that everybody can feel like they have a voice and are heard on your board? So that's one type of practice to think about. Another one is thinking about how you evaluate your board activities and the projects and practices that you're doing on your board. And so that's something else that we'll be thinking about this year. So with this inclusive training, it's happening at a good time for us because, as you know, we're doing both our strategic planning process as well as this year we're going to be working with a consultant to evaluate the civic engagement of our board meetings themselves. And so both of those processes will be helping us think through what is, what kind of inclusive environment are we creating on this board. So I hope you will all join us over the year in kind of thinking about those issues. And I'd like to just turn it over to John. He was also at the training and might have some different thoughts and reflections about this.
Thanks, Katie. I've been on the Environmental Quality Board now for 7 years, and this is the first time I have sat in front of you presenting. And I'm so thankful that No, because now I'm on the same level. Now, before, I'd be looking up, which is intimidating, but not now. Well, Katie did a very good job of covering what we went over during that presentation. And I guess My comments would be more just some of my impressions, some of the impressions I got during the presentation. The citizen members have been talking about training, board training, now for quite a number of years. We felt like that's something that's really missing, not just for our board, but overall in the state and state government and in the state as a whole. So this was a great opportunity to partake in some training. A drawback of the training is it was only 2 hours long. So how much can you cover in 2 hours? Katie did it in 4 minutes. But I think much more is needed. And I think the reason for this is, how many people do you think were there, Katie?
I'd say 60.
60. There were a lot of people there. They were from boards and committees and commissions all over the state. And they were all really hungry to learn about how to be effective board members. And I think one of the reasons for this is what's happening in our country today, in our state, the impasse at those levels of government. And people are realizing to get things done, we really need to work at the ground level and get them done that way, work from the lower level up. So very enthusiastic people. I wanted to give a shout out to the EQB staff because these notebooks in front of you are fantastic. And I would really doubt that the majority of the boards represented there had something like this. It's what you need, at least for the basics of serving on the EQB. So thank you, Will and staff, for what you've done there. Just a second what Katie covered. I think we really need to expand our recruitment in terms of, especially on the citizen side. We don't have any control on the EQB as far as the governor and his appointments. But I think we really need to be intentional in the future, going out and bringing back members that are underrepresented, marginalized, and people that just normally would not have the opportunity to serve on a board. I think that's very important right now. And also, as we go out and address an audience or our stakeholders, the people that are sitting out there that have questions and comments, I think, I know we've talked about this, going out to the state, out into the state and going where the people are, and also telling them we're coming and what we're going to talk to them about. I think that's, right now, that's very important. And those are my comments. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Katie and John. Any questions? I know while you were doing your board training in terms of inclusion and diversity, we also were having the opportunity to go through that process. And I last week spent 3 hours, 3.5 hours at the Comcast building in downtown, well, just over the bridge, going through the same process, and it was incredibly enlightening, and you can teach an old dog new tricks, I guarantee. So I was really pleased to be able to go through. We're being joined by another commissioner, Aline. Maybe you could introduce yourself to our new board members. Aline and I had the opportunity to travel together to Dallas, Fort Worth, to visit with the Burlington Northern Santa Fe folks here last week, and had a good opportunity to understand from them, you know, the services that they provide, both in moving people and moving soybeans. So.
Great. So my name is Aline Churimoff, and I'm the chair of the Metropolitan Council. What else was included in the introduction?
You had to sing your high school cheer song. Oh. You had to do that. You know?
I don't know that I know it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I apologize.
You know,
but so we're delighted to participate in the EQB. I think the Met Council, obviously, we're not a statewide agency, but we our area of jurisdiction is the 7-county metro. And we provide long-range transportation planning, land use planning for our local communities. We run the largest Section 8 voucher program in the state of Minnesota. We operate the Metropolitan Wastewater Treatment Facilities, which has an impact, I think, on the quality of our water overall, and Metro Transit. I would be remiss if I left them out. So,
thank you. All right. Thanks, John and Katie. Let's move then to the next item on the agenda, which is designation of a responsible governmental unit, RGU, for environmental review. It is, you'll also find it, the letter on page, I think it's on page 12 of your packet, a letter from the Lake County requesting that the EQB designate Lake County as the RGU as allowed under 4410. And then you'll also see right behind that at on page 13, the letter to Will from Kate Fairman, Environmental Review Planning Director, indicating that the DNR is willing to transfer the RGU status for Split Rock Wilds Mountain Bike Trail Project to Lake County. Any comments, questions, concerns? Tom, do you want to address it?
You know, very little, Mr. Chair. Just, you know, the statute provides, so the statute and rule provide for this transfer of authority, and oftentimes the RGU, local unit of government, will ask DNR or one of the other agencies to take something on that's very complicated, complex. This is something that is really not complicated or complex, and really the local folks are going to have the best knowledge of the situation and so on, so it really does make sense. For them to take it. You know, our staff, we've got a great environmental review staff. They've been working on things like PolyMet and Fargo-Moorhead diversion. And so anytime we have the opportunity to pass on something that is less demanding, it certainly makes sense.
Also, in the Lake County letter, they address the fact that there is only 2,500 feet of the entire planned trail that is actually on school trust land, which would be in your wheelhouse, and out of the 20 to 25 miles, apparently you have worked or your people have worked with Lake County. They will, you will be part of the process moving forward, but the RGU status would, by our action, would change the RGU status from DNR.
Right. As one of the landowners, we'll be involved still in the trail design and so on. But that, you know, a little different perspective than the RGU.
Other questions or comments on the request? I assume we have a motion. Anything else?
A representative from Lake County and the DNR are here as well.
Okay.
If you guys have questions,
yeah. Absolutely. Please. Come on up. Welcome.
Thanks.
Sorry to make you walk all the way up here. Okay. Throw the mic back at you.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nate Ide. I'm the land commissioner for Lake County, and I just wanted to thank you for your consideration. Lake County and
thank you for your clear and concise letter.
Oh, you're welcome. Lake County and the county board are very excited. Local riders are excited for a pretty neat opportunity for a mountain bike trail between Split Rock Lighthouse and Beaver Bays, looking at the lake, kind of secluded, rustic, wild-type trail that should add to the local economy and kind of create in the momentum or help the momentum of the mountain bike trail in northeast Minnesota. So
is it like rocks and logs that you have to navigate over, under, and around?
Yes, all of the above, yeah.
Right.
Hmm.
Yeah, yes, if you... Okay,
I thought that you were going to ask him. Is it a black diamond level or what? Maybe you don't have the terminology.
There will be some of that, but it's meant for all levels.
You have to have like big fat tires?
There might be, yeah.
Mine has to have a motor on it. All right.
So I'm here for any questions.
Mr. Chair, just one other observation. We met with Nate and some of the county board members as well. There's going to be some other additional collaboration because this will actually have a trailhead at the Split Rock campground, DNR campground. So we'll have become, you know, not only is it going to be an outstanding attraction on its own, but it'll complement sort of the existing state assets there as well.
Right.
So we're excited from that standpoint as well.
Great. Well, if you need someone to stand up there and pass out water bottles, I'm your guy. I'm kind of into the 1K mosey.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a question?
Yeah, please. Speak into the mic.
Yes. How closely does this trail follow the North Shore Hiking Trail?
There will be a few shared sections, but only when we have to. And for example, there's a beaver flowage crossing that they could use some help with their crossing, and it's the only place to cross a pretty large valley. So that's one place that we've talked with them, and we would probably share the trail. But other than that, we're going to try to stay away from it. But it's in the same neck of the woods. So if you've been on that Superior Hiking Trail, you kind of know what it's like. It's pretty neat, pretty special.
And I assume you're working with the North Shore Trail. And
absolutely. Yeah. Yep.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments? If not, thank you, Nate.
You're welcome.
And I think we're ready for the motion. And so I would like a motion indicating the transference of the RGU status from the DNR to Lake County. Is there a motion to that effect? There is. Is there a second to the motion? There is. Further discussion on the motion? We need a roll call.
Mm-hmm. Right. Commissioner Mosman, question.
Okay.
On the motion to adopt the resolution on page 15 in your packet and the findings, Commissioner Fredrickson?
Yes.
Ms. Idy Tollison?
Yes.
Commissioner Malcolm?
Yes.
Mr. Forsberg?
Yes.
Ms. Gehring?
Yes.
Commissioner Hardy?
Yes.
Ms. Knuth?
Yes.
Commissioner Lamware?
Yes.
Commissioner Luman?
Yes.
Commissioner Mosman?
Yes.
Mr. Murdoch?
Yes.
The motion passes.
The motion is passed, and so, John?
Mr. Chair, what was my name called?
You're a good catch. No, it was not.
I was dreaming, but not that much. Yes.
How do you vote, Mr.
Yes.
My apologies.
All right. Your excuse. Thank you. We will move then to the next item on the agenda, which is item 6, the election of a vice chair of the Environmental Quality Board. So nominations are now open for the position of vice chair. Historically, at least from my perspective, it's always come from the citizen members at this point in time. I just for the record.
Mr. Chair, I would like to nominate Kate Knuth.
Kate
for vice
Knuth
chair.
Has yes. been nominated. Are there other nominations? Are there other nominations? Are there any other nominations? You just about got nominated, Secretary. Seeing no more, I would direct the Executive Director to cast a unanimous ballot for. Do we need a roll call? Don't need a roll call for Kate Knuth. Yeah, okay.
Now we'll really be able to.
Yeah, I know it. Okay, let's go then to item number 7, EQB Energy and Environmental Report Card. Will.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Madam Vice Chair. We're actually doing the strategic, we're switching around the agenda a little bit. We're doing the strategic plan update, and then Eric and Katie will follow me shortly, but.
I'm sorry. That's what that arrow meant. This one would go down. Yeah, got it.
That's all right. We could have updated it beforehand and made it much easier for you. So, first off, I want to recognize everybody for spending a full day with us on January 31st to participate in the retreat. I thought it was very, very valuable. There was a lot of useful dialogue, constructive. Good suggestions and ideas were shared. I just want to remind everybody that, that the retreat is the beginning of about a six-month process at creating a five-year strategic plan for the board. You know, our goal is really to outline a vision where we're going over the next 5 years and identify some strategies to get there and some indicators that we can measure how we're doing. So to just revisit the process a little bit. So we had our full-day retreat in January. Today we're going to spend a short period of time just reviewing the mission statement options that were identified in hopes that we can narrow that down. In March, we're going to begin some stakeholder work. So with that, we're going to reach out to a lot of partners that work with the board, local governments, industry, NGOs, citizens, other individuals that follow some of our work or participate in environment review or other initiatives that the board is involved in and get their input into this process as well. So that's going to start in March, and that will go throughout the spring and into the early summer. And then in April, our facilitator will come back and work with you all in this setting as a full board on trying to identify a number of results statements. And so we started this process at our retreat, but she'll work with you on some decision making to hone in on results statements. She'll be back again in May to then explore different strategies. And in June and July, we'll be working on indicators. And so if we stay on track, that's how the next couple months will look like with respect to the strategic plan. You know, the one variable in there is sometimes our agendas get pretty full by action items or other things that get put on there. So if we can't maintain the schedule, we might have to schedule a side half day or short session to do some of this work with you all. So we'll just communicate with you as we move forward. But this is a good snapshot of how we get to a five-year strategic plan by the end of the summer. So I want to share this with you. I had a similar slide at the retreat, but I wanted to share this again to give you a sense of some of the questions that, you know, we as EQB staff are trying to really flesh out through the strategic plan process. You know, at a very top level, it's really what is our focus over the next 5 years and how do we know if we've been successful? But we really want to meaningfully think through this question of engagement and how do we engage beyond our limited stakeholder universe, and how do we strategically use our regular meetings and our offsite meetings to meaningfully connect and engage with Minnesotans, and having this project with the Department of Human Rights happen concurrently is really going to help help move this question along and give us some meaningful answers. And how do we best use the limited resources we have, combined with our broad statutory authority and our unique composition, which is you all as agency leaders? How do we find the sweet spot between those three things in really making the biggest impact? And how can we boil that down to be accountable to the charge of MEPA? Another question that we really want to explore throughout this is how do we create a culture of problem solving across the agencies? We do a lot of work on different projects, but you know, how do we identify those things that really work well? And how do we nurture those, enabling the board to be a more effective place for agencies to initiate meaningful interdepartmental work? You know, the next two bullets highlight different projects we have that are authorized in statute or executive order. You know, we want to think about these not just as one-offs and reports that are interesting, but how do we use them systematically to drive outcomes and oversight and add value going forward? And then how do we measure the effect of raising awareness? You know, we take pretty seriously this charge of educating the public and raising awareness, but how do we measure that, and then how do we move beyond that information education piece to meaningful action? So some really big questions that we're wrestling with, but I just want to remind you that's kind of why we're doing this endeavor. I'm going to go through these are just some takeaways that our staff team picked up on from our meeting a couple weeks ago, but then I want to pause and ask you all, I don't want to put you on the spot and go around the room, but maybe if some of you have some key takeaways or thoughts that you want to share with us, that you maybe didn't get an opportunity to share at the retreat, you are certainly welcome. You know, one of the big takeaways that we had was when we went around the room at the very beginning of the meeting and asked a question about kind of topically, what should the board really be thinking about, focused on over the next 5 years? Probably more than 80% of you said climate, identified climate as an area where there is a vacuum and the need is urgent, and this is an issue that the board should continue to be engaged in. There was a lot of discussion about the board's role as a pretty critical platform for interagency coordination, but that our emphasis should be on issues that are more long-term in nature and not project-based initiatives that are more short-term. There was also a lot of discussion about making use of these meetings to be less about presentations to and more as opportunities to enable richer discussion. There were some conversations that really struck us about the relationship between board leadership of projects and staff leadership of projects. And oftentimes we start a lot of our work with a conversation here at the board, and then staff are assigned. But if we really want to make sure these are really impactful, that we want to sustain that board leadership and oversight role. And then coming up at the end of this year, that transition is really an important opportunity for us to think about cementing best practices and some of the work that we do to relate to your agencies on the staff level, making sure those systems are functioning effectively so we can seamlessly carry forward a lot of this work. So those were some of the key takeaways that our staff team had from the conversations that we were part of at the retreat. But I want to pause there and see if invite some comments from any of our board members who did participate, if they had thoughts that they wanted to share, maybe takeaways from the retreat.
Tom?
So I know we talked about it. I don't know how you necessarily sort these, but the board is also kind of a public face, public discussion opportunity. And so I think that continues to be really important. And it's not just the meetings, it's the outreach we've done. It's the, Environmental Congress and 25 by 25. I think that's a really important function, especially because it is, citizens and multiple agencies at the table.
Other comments? Will?
Great. So now's the fun part. Now we're going to ask you to make some decisions here. So the mission statement, we tried to do a group writing exercise and that was fun. these are the three statements that got the most support, and we tried to wordsmith these a little bit after the meeting and wanted to kind of bring them back to you all to see if we have some sense of consensus here on which mission statement we should adopt and carry forward in our strategic plan going forward. The top one, which is bolded, is the one that seems to have the most support right now, and I'll just read it out. Enhance environmental quality by working together with partnering agencies to engage the public and make decisions on critical environmental issues. So this tries to weave together that collaboration, partnership work, public engagement, and then the decision-making is kind of a nod to the environmental review work that we do. The second one, enhance environmental quality for current and future generations by leading public engagement and interagency coordination, another popular choice there. This one, we took the current and future generations part from MEPA. We really liked that. But as well as the leadership question, concept that's embedded in this one. But we also didn't know if it was a little overly ambitious to suggest that we lead public engagement and interagency coordination in that regard. So, and then the final one is it just builds off of the second one, but adds some language explicit to environmental review that in facilitating informed decision making through environmental review. So if anyone, I welcome any comments on any of these. Otherwise, I would be curious to see maybe with a show of hands what your preferences are to know how much more work we have to do at pulling these together.
Wordsmithing by committee here. So there are several ideas in each of these I think that are important, and I could actually see taking parts of three of them that would get to where I think you've captured everything. So, for instance, take the first phrase from the second bullet, enhance environmental quality for current and future generations, substitute in the beginning for the phrase in the beginning, so enhance by working together with partnering agencies to engage the public. And I think informing the fact that we bring information is important as well. So, in facilitating informed environmental decisions. So take this first phrase of the second bullet and the last phase of the third bullet and substitute those on the first bulleted sentence.
I thought I was tracking you.
So let me start from the beginning.
You should say words.
Yeah. So it would say, enhance environmental quality for current and future generations by working together with partnering agencies to engage the public and making and facilitating informed decision-making, period.
Would you mind reading that one more time a little slower?
A little slow. Enhance environmental quality for current and future generations by working together with partnering agencies to engage the public and facilitating informed decision making. Period. So it captures future, you know, enhancing environmental quality. It captures current and future generations, captures partnering agencies and engaging the public, and it captures both decision making and information gathering.
You want one mission statement instead of three bullets in.
Well, I think that's three options is the way I look at it.
Okay.
Combining
together. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think having the idea of leadership in there is really important. I think if you look under statute of what our charge is, it's more than partnering and engaging. It's identifying, and I think a lot about leadership, and we actually have really problematic language in English around leadership for what actually leadership is. So it's not so much claiming that we lead, but we offer leadership, that's a way I would say it. It's more about the leadership itself than about us leading, which sounds like a subtle nuance, but there's an important point in there. But I do think it's important for us to be clear that our job is not solely to partner and collaborate and engage, although that is clearly an important part of our job. It's also to identify and understand emerging and future-looking issues in a way that I think other single agencies... This is a unique platform in which we can look at what's coming and the complex nature of it from the perspective of many agencies with citizen members. So I think that leadership idea is really important. And I, you know, could use a slightly different language, but I think it's important to me that that's an idea that's captured in our mission statement. It's a much more active view of the board that I think is part of our statutory authority.
Do you have any language to recommend?
I mean, I wrote one at the thing, but it's not up there. That might have been a vision. I struggle with what mission and vision is. I could write a different one, but... I would just say keeping the idea of leadership in there is important.
Mm-hmm. Chantier?
I think we, kind of along those lines of leadership, I think we have to be very clear that we're making decisions here, and that's important. So that's one piece related to that. And I think... And I don't have the words for this second piece, but I want to make sure that how we talk about public engagement, that it's not a one-way street, that we're coming to you with all of our wisdom and leadership and to your communities and to your project, but somehow we have to make sure that it's articulated as a two-way street. Because information can come to this board that we're not on the ground that can have complete total impact to the rest of the state. But if we have not created an environment that there's two-way engagement, we'll never know that because we're not on the ground. And so somehow we have to make sure that when we articulate that engagement that It's two-way.
Other comments or questions? Kristen?
I just want to second what the commissioner just said, because I think this board is, composition is evidence that environmental quality is a public-public partnership. It's a partnership of government and the people, and that's embedded in MIRA, and so that... yeah, I think I would vote for number three, although I originally voted for the one that Kate wrote. So I hope we get some more voting opportunities. But I agree with the commissioner that that's really a central piece.
Please.
Hi.
Can you identify yourself?
I'm Ellen Hadley from Anoka.
Hi. I'm Ellen Hadley from Anoka, a retired teacher, person on the ground. I noticed that your retreat key takeaways, the very first one was the board should take a leadership role on climate. But then in your mission statement, the word climate doesn't appear. And I was wondering why you took that out.
Thank you. Will?
Sure. Yeah.
Or if it could be added.
Yeah, our mission statement is trying to draw our explicit authorities in statute, and they're not topically organized. They're kind of organized under our broader charges related to interagency coordination, environmental review, and public engagement. And so that's kind of the approach that we tried to take with these mission statements, but certainly it sounds like there's more work we need to do. So I was advised this wouldn't be easy, but I thought, let's give it a shot and see if there, yeah. But that's why we didn't try to identify any topics.
Other comments?
Yeah, so we'll bring some more options back. This was helpful, though. Thank you for identifying some key themes that are important to you all. So we will continue to wordsmith. So I'm going to jump to set aside the strategic plan. And as I outlined in the slide earlier, this is going to come back in front of you at multiple points throughout the next couple of months here. So we'll keep you updated. Meanwhile, there's a lot of other work going on. And so I just want to give you a sense of what is happening and what you'll see in board meetings here throughout the calendar year. There's a lot of work happening related to environmental review, continuous improvement. So in April, you'll get a deeper dive on the work of the panel and some of these projects, but I'm going to give you a little bit of a high level right now. We completed the 12th meeting of the Environmental Review Advisory Panel. This was a panel of stakeholders that sought to bring together expertise of environmental review practitioners from state and local governments, some folks who prepare, consultants and industry that prepare environmental review documents, also some advocacy organizations that participate in this process on behalf of citizens, and try to have a conversation about how we can modernize the environmental review program. It's been a really interesting and constructive discussion over 12 months, but there's more work to be done. So the group agreed to continue to break off some of the issues that they're working on into different subgroups. And to give you an example of some of the topics and content that the panel covered, we looked at topics ranging from how can climate change and public health be more consistently embedded into environmental review, EAWs and EISs, as well as how can we identify or craft opportunities for streamlining or alternatives for projects that might be reviewed in other ways, as well as public engagement. So there are a number of topics covered by the panel, but we'll bring back a deeper dive to the board in April as they move some of this work forward. The mandatory category rulemaking is a rulemaking that you will see probably late spring, early summer. It's mostly housekeeping updates to a handful of categories of the agencies I've identified over the last couple of years to some of the categories that trigger environmental review. We put out a couple of requests for comments over the last couple of years. We did an update to the board last year. But we'll, as the panel has moved forward, we have been exploring some additional mandatory category revisions. So we'll bring all this back and share it with the board here later this spring. But you should expect to see some additional work in the mandatory category rulemaking. And just as a side note, that's also including some other rules that the legislature mandated pertaining to recreational trails as well as silica sand. So it is kind of a snowball of a lot of different rule revisions, and so we'll share that with you as that gets moved forward. We've also, over the last couple of years, have been doing surveys with our RGUs as well as our project proposers, and this year also citizens. And so we're trying to mine these surveys for information about the impact of some of these reviews and areas where there can be improvements. So we're going to use that to try to ground truth some of the policy recommendations that come out of the ERAP. And then finally, the communications area. You know, last year we put out some web videos on environmental review. We're looking at updating some additional guidance materials, and we're looking at trying to make the EAW form electronic so you can go in and actually fill it out online and submit it there. So those are some environmental review things that we're working on right now, so expect those to come to you as a board over the next handful of months. The strategic plan, we already covered that. On the public engagement side, Katie made mention to the civic engagement evaluation that we're doing with the Department of Human Rights. We were one of three projects in the state that were selected as pilots to do some additional study there. We'll keep you posted as that moves forward. But in addition, we're looking to do 2 to 3 offsite meetings, and we're starting to plan for our 2019 Environmental Congress. And so Katie and Eric are going to talk a little bit about that, as well as if we move to the interagency coordination piece, our energy and environment report card, which we're also starting to develop for the end of the year here. Recently, we were awarded as a participant on an NGA, which is the National Governors Association, Water Energy Nexus project. And just to explain a little bit, the National Governors Association is trying to support some state innovation in terms of policy development or other program development to try to advance energy and water co-benefits in different areas of state policy. And so Commerce really championed this application, and so this project is getting started here in the next couple of weeks. We're also supporting Executive Order 1607, which was signed to advance pollinator health in Minnesota, and part of that, we're supporting the work of a governor's committee of pollinator experts and trying to identify different policies and opportunities the state can identify to move to better pollinator outcomes in the state of Minnesota. And then the final thing noted on this is that we're also beginning to think about and have discussions with your agencies about our next state water plan, which is due in 2020. It seems like a long ways away, but things move pretty quickly, and we want to make sure that there is a seamless connection between the 25 by 25 work that you all did and the public engagement that was part of that with the Clean Water Roadmap update that state agencies are working on, and this, so that these aren't all a bunch of one-off state planning documents that are tailored to different constituencies, but that these things actually are connected and work together. And then finally, you know, we've spent a lot of staff time trying to support the Green Step Cities program and explore ways that we can look to building it out to other jurisdictions. We're working with the University of Minnesota to see how the Green Step Schools program can kind of build on this and bring school districts into this work. And so that's a very high level sampling of some of the projects that we're putting staff resources into in 2018. It's not an exhaustive list, but it's some of the high level stuff that you all will see come before you here in the next year. So I'm just going to jump here a little bit other business before I turn it over to Eric and Katie to do a little bit of a deeper dive on our Environmental Congress and Energy and Environment Report Card. I went over the board member handbook, so we can jump past that. Staff engagement survey. So this is just something we We have some really outstanding staff that we bring on board here at the EQB. But because they work with such great people in your agencies, they tend to find promotional opportunities very quickly. So we have a staff retention challenge that we're working with the continuous improvement people at MPCA to survey staff, current and former staff, to see if there are opportunities that we can to try to help either retain staff for a longer duration or keep the pipeline full of really talented people. So I just wanted to express, we heard that at our retreat, and it is something that we take seriously, but also see it as a positive for state government overall. So that said,
you indicated that you have some fairly outstanding. So, like, what would outstanding be?
That's a tough question, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to be modest, though. No, they are outstanding. Yeah. In any event, the board meeting space is just to note, this is our first, for those of you, this is your first meeting. This is the first time we are not sitting at the dais. We have outgrown that very quickly. And so I would appreciate your feedback. You don't have to give it to me now, but offline, if you have concerns about how this is arranged, otherwise, you know, as the chairman mentioned, I think the long-term plan with this meeting space is to tear out the dais, because we were the last board that actually had used it, and move forward with a setup like this, and we would move it back this way a little bit so there's more space for the public when we talk about issues that are of interest to more participants. So please let me know offline if you have thoughts about space. And then the only other thing on here before we move forward to just to adopting a couple policies is transition planning. We're really starting to think about, you know, that we have the strategic plan that is set up to be that external facing larger document that looks forward to the next 5 years and what we're doing as a board on a high level. But we're also looking at how do we relate to agencies, you know, not at the leadership level, but through tech reps and other interagency teams to try to figure out what is the best model going forward so that this work can really move forward seamlessly. And so that is something we'll engage your staffs in too. So I'm running out of breath, but before I finish up, I just want to, I've got two housekeeping policies that I'm looking for the board to approve. Let me pull them up. One is on reimbursement policy, and the other is records policy. So if you just give me a moment to get organized here. And just to clarify, neither reflect a change in practice, and both are consistent with state law, which should go without saying, but I will say it anyways. The reimbursement policy, what we're doing here is, you know, we took language directly from statute, but the one part that we are supposed to do as a board is to prescribe what constitutes a day, okay? And so we outline that as regular and special meetings, so what you're here for today, as well as annual work plan retreats.
It's on page 27 of your packet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Three. I'm sorry, Will, to cut you
off. No, I appreciate that you did that, as well as work plan retreats, attending the Environmental Congress, participating as an appointee on board-appointed advisory councils, and or representing the board at events and meetings with prior approval by either the chair or the executive director. And so these are board-related activities that constitute a day and will be eligible for citizen members for reimbursement as spelled out here. And so this is all taken from statute in terms of what's allowable, but that is how we define a day. So that is that policy. As for records and data management, we work closely with the MPCA, so all of our data practice requests go through the MPCA. The thing here that is substantive is this last part, which is directing me to develop a record retention schedule and request approval from the state records disposition panel. So it's really just what we would do is we would put together a schedule that shows, and our primary records as a board are our board meeting agendas and minutes and audio, because that is what constitutes board action, board transactions, and so that is what we are working on with the state disposition office. So I'm happy to take questions. Those are the two housekeeping policies that we are seeking approval for at this time.
Questions? Kristen.
My question has to do with how long the audio is available. Is there a limit for the state, or is there a standard, or, you know, as a citizen, I like going back and looking at those. So what can you tell me about those?
Yeah, right now we keep them in perpetuity. So that's our practice. And we have no, it's possible right now. When you look at the statute, when it was written, it talked about video cassettes and all these things that technology has rendered obsolete. And so I'm sure at some point how we have that audio will be rendered obsolete. But at this point, we don't. I mean, we keep everything. Yeah. There is a concern ongoing that the video might become too large to maintain over time. But we do keep the audio, and then we also, we also have minutes too. So, yeah.
Other questions? Seeing none, is there a motion to approve the policy instead of management 27? It would be the approve and adopt the environmental quality per diem and expense policy. There is a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Second. Is there further discussion on the motion to adopt a policy regarding per diem and expenses? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. The second one would be, I believe, on 37, 38, 39, a motion to approve the Environmental Quality Board Record and Data Management Policy. Is there a motion to that effect? There is. Is there a second? There is further discussion on the motion to adopt the EQB Records and Data Management Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. Tom?
Forgot about that. Let me make an observation on the previous. Did we vote? Did we just vote on the second one? We did. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's timely to bring back the first one, which we already voted on.
This is the first time I've ever been accused of moving
to. You have to step up that 1K. What's that 1K saunter? What's it?
Yeah, it's 1K.
Mosey. Mosey, you're going to have to step that up to a saunter. Mr. Chair, my observation is that that reimbursement rate of $55 has been in place like forever. And this does not apply to state officials. I wonder if there's not an opportunity for the state to perhaps take a lead on trying to adjust that reimbursement rate.
Well, there'd be one way to find out.
The rate is set in the statute, Commissioner. Yeah,
I understand that. So somebody has to change the statute. Somebody has to initiate a statute change. I guess that's what I'm wondering.
Sounds like a DNR legislative initiative to me. But it's a point well taken, though.
Yeah.
I think the most recent addition to this section of law actually was adding child care expenses as a way to try to, offset expenses there.
Okay. Let us move then to the next item on the agenda, and I believe that's report card.
Mm-hmm.
Eric and Katie, welcome.
Thanks.
Hi, good afternoon. Again, I'm Katie Pratt, staff member with EQB.
And I'm Eric Cedar-Lifdahl, also with EQB.
And we are here, we're this afternoon's dynamic duo, to talk about, don't laugh, it's true, to talk about the Minnesota Environmental Congress and the Environment and Energy Report Card. We have visuals. So what we want to do, we're currently scoping both of these projects. The Environmental Report Card is coming out at the end of this year, and the Environmental Congress we're planning for early in 2019. And we're in the process of scoping both of these projects. And so we want to spend some time this afternoon talking to you a little bit more about the projects, what we're thinking on them, getting your insight and your ideas and where we're headed. So sounds like a plan. We're also going to take a deep dive into one of the sections of the report card, which is the climate section. And we've brought some staff, some subject matter experts today to talk about that section with you as well. So here are the three questions we would love for you to keep in mind as we go through this information, and we'll put these questions back up in a little bit. But we want you to think about these projects. How can these two projects support your agency's strategic vision and your vision as citizen members? How can these two projects drive change as a state? So we're doing these, you know, because we want to get somewhere, not just to keep ourselves busy, although they do keep us very busy. And how can we build these two projects into an ongoing cornerstone of state environmental work? So as you might recall, this is kind of the second iteration of both of these projects under the sort of recent formation of the board. And as a second iteration, we're hoping to do these every 2 years and to really build on them so they become not something that's seen as a one-off project where we're coming up here every 2 years and asking you for staff time to contribute to these projects, but how they become something that we all collectively anticipate, that we look forward to, that we're already thinking, oh, when is that next report coming out? When is that next Congress happening? So that we can begin to align these projects with work that's going on in your own communities and in your agencies as well. So that's kind of the big picture that we want to get you thinking about. And Eric is going to start by talking about the report card.
All right. Thanks, Katie. So I'm Eric Cedarlift-Dahl from EQB staff, and I'm going to talk about the 2017 Environment and Energy Report Card, as well as kind of some of the scoping from the 2019 Environment and Energy Report Card. Then Katie's going to talk about the Congress, and then, as she mentioned, we'll be bringing some subject matter experts up to talk about the climate section of the report. So I'm going to guide you through the process that EQB staff utilized to develop the 2017 Report Card and the metrics associated with that. And then we'll go through that climate section. And the plan is, over the next year, is to come back four more times, and go through each section of the Environment and Energy Report Card, do a deeper dive so that we can really hear more about each section and spend more time with each of the indicators. So your packets contain a printout of the report card, but I also put a full report card on your desks, as well as they're over on the table if anyone in the audience wants to grab them. So what initiated the first Environment and Energy Report Card was in 2011, the governor issued an executive order, which is up here on the screen, which is 1132. The EQB shall prepare an Environment and Energy Report Card that identifies metrics which the state of Minnesota can use to measure its performance and progress protecting Minnesota's valuable air, water, and land resources. So in 2012, EQB put together their first iteration of the Environment and Energy Report Card, which I have right here. I didn't have enough copies to share with the whole board or the public, but it had five sections: air, energy, climate, land, and water. And in 2016, in preparation for the 2017 report card, EQB hosted an interagency meeting in which EQB member agencies and citizen members went through a results-based accountability, or RBA, process to determine which metrics or indicators should be in each section. So just to reorient the board toward the RBA process, since we've got some new members, the results-based accountability is a framework that uses data to explore accountability at a population and program level. There's communication power, proxy power, and data power. Communication power is basically how much power does a metric or indicator have, how does it effectively communicate, Proxy power is how well does the metric or indicator represent a broader picture of a subject area. And data power, how comprehensive is the available data? How long has it been collected, and how often will it be collected in the future? So we went through that process, and we came up with the indicators for the 2017 report there. The report card, which you have at your desks, which the actual report card, which shows different colors of green, yellow, and red, is a color scheme based on the Minnesota dashboard. Which has a current indicator status of green, yellow, or red, and a trend arrow of up, flat, or down.
So it's pretty self-explanatory, but green indicates a good current status, or in other words, that performance is ahead of desired progress toward state or national goals or established benchmarks. And yellow represents an okay status, or in other words, performance nearly meets public expectations. And red represents a poor current status. This means performance is well behind public expectations or desired progress towards state or national goals or agency or industry benchmarks. And then you'll see there are trend arrows as well on the report card area. Up means things are getting better. Flat means things are about the same. And down means things are getting worse. And on EQB's website, we have a much more detailed analysis of, you know, what at how we determined, how staff and subject matter experts actually determined the trend arrows and determined the color of the indicator or metric. Okay. So in scoping the 2019 Environment and Energy Report Card, we've developed some ideas and have some questions we'd like the board to weigh in now or sometime over the next few months as we're coming back to continue discussing the different sections of the report. So one of the ideas that we'll be doing is working with MPCA Communications to do in-house design and communications work that will help save resources and create a better product in the end. We received feedback that the 2017 report could be too dense at times and the key messages could be lost with some of the jam-packed pages. And so we're going to work with PCA Communications and the interagency staff team to simplify the pages and hone in on key messages. Our vision over time is that more and more of the E&E report will live online, connecting with Minnesotans through social media and EQB's website acting as a hub to point people to the great data, studies, and programs agencies are already working on. So those are some of the ideas that we're beginning to scope out, but then we have some questions that I'd open up to the board today or over the next few meetings. Some of the questions are that EQB wants this report, as Katie has mentioned, to be an effective and meaningful report that aligns with member agency goals, strategic visions, and helps support stories and initiatives that further environmental and energy policy. If you have ideas or story ideas, please let us know today or over the next few months as we come back. Another question relates to indicator effectiveness and the rate of change of some of these indicators. You know, coming up with a report card every 2 years, some of these indicators move rather slowly, and they may not change. And so as we've ramped up scoping of the 2019 report, it's a good time to ask if the indicators are the right indicator that best communicates the key message, or if another indicator or metric would better communicate the status of Minnesota's environment and energy. If you feel that a metric or indicator is in one of the sections should be updated because it would be more effectively represent changes to Minnesota's environment or energy or climate, please let us know or over the next few months as we scope this. Another idea that staff has been bandying about is due to the slow rate of change, some or all of these indicators, we could create a new set of base layers for 2019. So this is kind of a graphic look at this here, is that we created the first set of base indicators in 2017. We could go through another RBA process with staff and the board in 2019 and come up with a new set of base indicators that better represent current issues like, you know, such as chlorides or pollinators or other issues that the last report didn't capture in indicators. And then we would flip-flop between those every 2 years so that we would see potentially more change over the years. And so I'd appreciate any feedback today or over the next a couple meetings. And I'll pause for a second to see if anyone has any feedback on that idea or any of the indicators.
Just a couple of thoughts, Mr. Chair and Eric. I think, well, some of these may change very slowly. I think they're still very important to monitor. And so maybe you're right, maybe you can do it every 10 years, but I think you know, water quality, for instance. I mean, if we're not monitoring water quality, then we're really missing one of the big things. And the other is, I think part of the reason we picked these is because they are things we are already measuring. Yep. And so part of the challenge is if we want to switch to something else, we have to make sure that it's likely something we're already measuring because we're not going to start measuring something else.
Elaine?
Thank you.
you. Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciate having the opportunity to comment on some of these measures. I think that they really do align well with the Met Council and our functions. And if you look kind of at water quality, thinking about that as we're in some cases providing input as we release effluent from our wastewater treatment facilities, when we think about transit and transit ridership, you know, we obviously have a very big role to play there. One of the questions I have is, how do we communicate when we look at these metrics overall and we're looking at how we're doing kind of over time, but just as a report card, and transit's kind of the one that jumps out at me, where we see fewer, a reduction in the expansion of transit, and maybe even though we're trying to increase the system overall, how do we communicate how we move the dial on some of these? And so that's kind of one of the things that we think about, but maybe we should think about as a board when we're talking about something like air quality, or actually all of the measures overall. Are there specific actions that we would want to consider as they relate to improving the metrics?
Mr. Chair, since Liam brought it up, I'll follow up on that. I think it goes back to Eric's previous question, that is, how do we align with agency priorities? It seems to me that when we do something like this, it does give us a snapshot of where issue areas are where we could work. It seems to me the next step for the board might be asking ourselves, spending a little bit of time looking at the report card and saying, okay, based on this, what ought we be doing differently? And maybe we develop kind of the concept level policy things that the agencies can, you know, choose to pick up or debate among the board about how we might move something forward as a policy change.
Sean, Tara.
So back to updating the indicators, can you just, I'm just trying to wrap my mind around the flipping back and forth, the messaging around that, and to the point regarding, you know, how are we articulating, have we moved the needle? Like, how do you message that if you're, especially if you're moving the base? Like, I'm just trying to understand from a trend perspective, how are you telling that story? And if we don't do this approach, what are we losing? Like, I'm just trying to understand why would we go after this new model?
Eric or Katie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, you know, I don't know if I have an answer to that question today. I was interested in your feedback. I think you could still, you know, incorporate some of these metrics, but I just thought, you know, if you look at, like, in the water section, you know, like, we didn't, infrastructure and chloride and wetlands and even contaminants of emerging concern, those all tell pretty big stories in the intro of the water section if you go to page 10. And it just felt like there could be more opportunity to tell a broader picture of the work agencies are doing, as well as some of the issues Minnesota's facing. But I don't know how to connect the two bases right yet. It's still kind of in a brainstorming phase.
Just to tag on to what Eric's saying, I think the idea is not that the first set of indicators goes away. It's just a way to track more things. So right now we have 15 total indicators, but there's some stuff that's missing, like pollinators is one Eric mentioned that kind of came online since these indicators were created. And so we could start tracking pollinators. We could add in more indicators and have 30 total indicators. But rather than creating a 50-page report every 2 years, we would just report out on some of them every 2 years and then the next batch every 2 years. And the rest of them could live online, so you could always go see any number of any of the indicators. And again, this is just an idea. We're not attached to it by any means, but the bigger question is, are we missing things that need to be in here?
That's a great question. I don't have the answer. I guess for me, I guess I would be, since we're having this brainstorming conversation, I think I would be more interested in understanding how you get on the list. You know, just because it's hot and flashy, does it get on the list? Or based on kind of these base indicators, like did chloride hit a certain level, a certain destruction in a community that it warranted us to put it on the list as an indicator? I guess I would be interested in having that conversation first about how you get on the list and the principles, and then from there, because then everything hot and flashy can jump on the list, and I guess I'm very interested in that messaging piece and how you tell that story, because then if we're awesome, we solved it in 6 months. You know.
Actually, John Stein, then Kate, then Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
I have written down.
I wanted to just offer one observation that has daunted me throughout my career, which is sort of the silos of environmental components trap that water, air, land, people, economic activity, all we measure them in discrete ways in what I think of now in problematic ways for people, because people want to know. They do want to know, is the air clean and healthy to breathe? Is the water safe to swim in? Are the fish okay to eat? Those are logical questions people ask us, but they don't really ask the question about how is the environment doing, which I think we're trapped in. One of my colleagues from Maryland calls it cylinders of excellence, silos of looking at environmental data in discrete ways without integrating environmental data in a more systemic way. So what challenges me when I look at a report like this is, if I were a regular citizen picking this up, I don't know what to make of the state of our environment. So I think it's frustrating to people to give them a report card that has too many measures in it. And I think the actual answer is not there yet, but we need something that describes in a more integrated way how Minnesota's environment is changing, less so about the conditions reporting. I think the change dynamic is what matters. When you tell people that it's warmer now in the winter in northern Minnesota, and they say, oh, that's why I can't snowmobile as often, for example. Or the season is shorter for me to be out ice fishing on some lakes. Those things are what I think change the way we think about it, rather than, you know, when I give a report on water quality and I say phosphorus has changed in this body of water by X, no one can relate that to what it is going on in their community. And I just think we are in a silo trap in this kind of a report.
Kate, right there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Then Matt. Then Jessica.
I would echo what Commissioner Stein said about environmental systems, and I don't have an answer to this question of how we pull together that systemic view. So I'll just add another challenging question. That's all to think about. Because I one of the things that I have increasingly been thinking about in terms of our environment is part of our challenge is the physical environment, but really it's how do we make decisions about and govern the way we interact with our environment. And I think we have some serious challenges in this area in terms of how data are used, how science is considered, how people are engaging with environmental decision-making or not. And so I think there's a potentially, not to add another section, but maybe to add another section, there's something around governance and how we're doing in terms of the way we're thinking about, or the way we're actually working on these things together. And obviously I think EQB has a role in that. And I think it's an interest, it could be a useful thing to put out to say this is not, yes, the outcomes are we want healthier things in all of these physical areas, and the way we also need to be aware of how we actually go about doing that. And so that I would put forward as a question of governance. There also may be something around questions of justice. So it could potentially be pulled out more fully in some of the sections around air and water, that some people in our state have a higher environmental burden than others. And do we as a board want to highlight that itself as we're tracking disparities in people's environmental impacts and the pollution loads they experience? Or do we want to just pull it out more fully in these different areas? I don't know the answer to that question, but I think it's worth asking that question because I think people do not experience the environment and their health is impacted in different ways by the environment. And we all know this, but I think being more explicit about that in this report card, whether we pull it out as its own category or are more clear about it in the different sections.
Matt? Mike? Thank you. And you know, as I didn't notice this as much when I was perusing quickly through the first part of the report, and so I think there's more of it in the back of the report, and I also really like the comments John made earlier, but the about the metrics, which is certainly one part of this and a core of the sort of accountability aspect that this is trying to get at. I mean, the question is, what should the metrics be? How do we talk about them? How do Minnesotans relate to them? But the other thing I think that there would be value in seeing a bit more explicitly is even with big picture metrics like this, it's a little bit easy for people who are not passionate about the environment to be a little bit lazy about doing anything to help. And that by people, I mean that's entities, that's individuals. And so it seems like there's value in being more explicit, not just about talking about what the measure is, but is there new technology in an area? What's the opportunity? What should people be doing? And I see some more of that in some of the elements in the back. But what's going to drive change? What needs to be done to drive change? What are simple things or difficult things? But what are things that need to be done if someone picks up this report and is using it as guidance to improve the metric?
Jessica?
First of all, I want to say this is a really neat report. So, I mean, there's just a lot of really cool, interesting, neat information in it. So I like that. I think the challenge, and I kind of want to echo Commissioner Stein's comments, actually, and I want to take those just a little bit further, because is the water, can you eat the fish? Can you breathe the air? I mean, I don't even think we answer that question in these reports. And I go to, again, it's a cool report. It's got lots of great graphs and really interesting information. I didn't know what a Cisco was. I'm sorry. So, I mean, again, it's kind of, how do we make it relatable to people? I knew what a walleye. But again, like, how do we make it relatable to people? How do we answer that fundamental question of that people do want to know? Because if we don't answer that question, then how are we going to get people to move somewhere that we need them to go? And I just look at 60% of lakes and rivers meet water quality standards is in on this page. Like, it's pulled out. And then I go back to the water, and I can't tell if 60% is good or bad. Right? A report card, like, tells you whether you're meeting or exceeding expectations. So I think that would be really helpful. And then I think also just in this report card category, back to Commissioner Hardy's comments around how do you get on the list. When I look at these, there's three indicators for each of our subjects. And these are a combination of different initiatives, different indicators, different measures. Some are solutions that we've already, like transit ridership is a solution. Right? How is that being measured compared to the air quality index? They don't really all fit together to tell one picture or one story about where we are today, and then even more about where do we want to be. You guys asked for feedback. We're providing feedback. I think that there's a lot of really excellent information here, but I think we do need to kick it up a notch if we want to make this a broader, a more accessible document to more people.
Kristen, did you have a comment?
Brian has a comment.
Oh, I'm sorry. Brian. Okay. Oh, she's already spoken.
Right. So this is a great document, I agree.
it can't do everything. So, you know, when you think about it right away is, you know, vapor and some of the other emerging things that we're working on, they're not in there. It seems to me that this could be a more comprehensive document if it looked at things more generally. With today's technology, people can click down into those details that you want. So if the report card was more of a basic view of how different categories are doing, with then an online resource for people to go and get more information and learn what they can do, otherwise this thing's going to double in size when you start adding everything to it. It almost seems like it's more of a electronic resource than it is a publication.
Kristen.
I agree. I'm really excited about the way that you guys are getting creative about how the web interactive piece might work. And when I first got a copy of this, I made my husband read it with me so that I would get through it and get some input other than my own. And he said, well, what's a Laurentian mixed forest province? He immediately picked up on the provinces, and that's where he entered into the report, is through the map and through seeing where he was in the provinces. And I think there's a lot of opportunity here to create some kind of regional, sub-regional approach that might even interact with, you know, our Congress or, you know, other initiatives. And I'm particularly excited that the web, what you said about the web interface, to point to data, reports from the agencies. I've been really interested in this question ever since coming onto the board. I know I've often, when somebody gives a great report, I go, okay, so how is the public going to access that report? And so I'm really excited about the way that you're thinking about that with this. And the last thing I want to say is that I think that it is important, and maybe time, to start really pulling together some of the economics of ecology. What are our water resources worth? What are some of these things literally worth? There's a lot of work in this area, and I don't know if it's something that we can get into, but I think it would be a really important thing for us to consider developing or working on. Thanks.
You know, I think what we're expressing here is that it is very complicated. And how do you take something so complicated? How do you consider adding additional parameters, or you're calling it metrics, and which ones, and then condense it down to something that makes sense? You know, from an engineer might want to take each one of these metrics and put a weight on them, and then multiply its quality and come up with a total score, and then from year to year, you can see if you're getting better or worse. That's very difficult. I don't know if it's even practical. I think what you're doing here is very nice in that you identify these, was it four or five areas, and then you've got your metrics for each of those areas and discussing them basically in a subjective way, that if you put the effort into it, it does make sense and you can get a sense for which way it's going. So there's value to keeping the same metrics as you move forward in the future. Otherwise, you're using a different yardstick every time you pick it up. And you look back 10 years, well, now my yardstick's not the same as I have now. We have this problem in surveying and using different datums, actually, I'm dealing with right now. So you can't, of course, keep the same ones forever, but there should be an effort to try to keep it uniform as you move forward so you can see what you're measuring and have a measuring stick.
Other comments, Tom?
Mr. Chair, just perhaps more mechanical and philosophical, but when this administration came in, some of these sort of routine things had disappeared. So we didn't do an environmental congress for a decade. I don't know when the last energy and environment report card came along, but we've now gotten into the habit of doing these recurrent things. And I think, you know, what I would ask is how do we use these for the work of the board? And I think, especially when we think about it in concert with, you know, developing policy or the environmental congress, we should be thinking of the cycle of activities here. And I think we've come to the conclusion that, at least in the past, that we should come up with a report card before environmental congress. We go to people, we say, here's the state of the union. It might be the time where we then ask people, what should we do? And then subsequent to that, develop action. So I think what I would suggest is we should be thinking about the cycle here a little bit. So we we get the maximum value out of the report card, because I think it really does two things. The report card informs the public, and so going out to the public with this helps spread that information, but then it also helps direct action. So it could direct us to be thinking about policies. And so thinking about how we use it, I think is very important.
John, Mr. Chair. Following up on what Commissioner Landwehr said, in terms of presenting this to the public, have we received input from the public telling us what they thought of it?
Eric? Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Not really specifically with the E&E. I mean, through the Congress and participation in some of the presentations at the Congress, folks seem really engaged with it. And when I talk to people, they seem really engaged with it, but not directly that I can recall. I'm looking to Will and Katie if they recall anything.
I just think that would be very helpful.
I think it's a useful suggestion, yeah. It certainly was kind of the focal point for both the Congress in 2012 and then again with the intent of being a document that engages the public. But in terms of actually identifying the metrics, no. So it's a good suggestion that you bring up for this one. Yeah. Well, I have the microphone, though. I'm going to make a couple other comments. This has been great feedback. I thought trying to wordsmith a mission statement was going to be hard. Good golly. I think, too, I just want to kind of come back to a broader question of what is successful here. I mean, the purpose of this exercise is not to somehow take over the work each of your agencies have in terms of providing that scientific data that can drive a lot of these decisions, okay? The PCA, you guys are a warehouse of numbers and science about water quality, air quality, all these things. This is trying to tell a broader story. It's trying to tell an interagency. It's not trying to say this is the best science that's out there. It's rooted in science, but this is more of a storytelling document. And it's timed at a point where we want to be putting it out at the beginning of every budget cycle at the legislature. So agencies, if you were to say what do I think would be a successful use of this report, we would put it out at the beginning of that budget making session, be able to tell a broader narrative on statewide environmental performance that could help set up agencies for success in actually hammering home, well, this year the focus is chlorides, and then PCA comes and explains what they're trying to do. So to the extent that it can do that, I think it is really valuable, and I think we got a lot of great feedback. I think I don't have clarity, though, in terms of indicators, because I heard two things. One is keep the same indicators because there is value and consistency, and I want to say that was in the back of everyone's mind. When we had an RBA session, it was about 2 years ago, with many of the faces here, it was very hard going from a universe of about 100 possible indicators into the ones we chose that we thought could tell the broadest story across all of these areas, with the understanding we wanted to do these kind of update them regularly. And our observation over the last 2 years is that it's probably going to be hard to show change, but it's still a useful exercise, but that there are other issues that that are really important now. We don't want to miss the opportunity to highlight them. So we're trying to find the sweet spot in terms of how we use words to tell the story that many of you have identified. But I guess we also need to maybe get some more direct feedback, and we can do this offline. If that's easiest, about do we pivot to different indicators? Because if we do, there is a resource request that we're going to have for you agency heads, because we're going to need to work with your teams at developing those data sets for new indicators. And so I want to just throw that out there, that there's a resource piece that we need to consider, too, on the staff level.
All right. Thank you. Thank you all very much for the great discussion. This is just a quick timeline. I'm going to kind of skip through it, but basically I'll be coming back to the board a couple more times this year. I'll also be bringing back each of the sections to go into more detail, which you'll be hearing from some of the staff here in a minute. And then we'll present this back to the board in December, but we'll be doing some regular check-ins with the board for, final approval of the report prior to it being finalized. So I want Katie to have her time, because she's got a lot to talk about with the Congress. So.
Yeah, and we're putting these together because we really do see the Congress and the report card as working together. And I would echo Commissioner Landwehr's call. It's like, we can put together reports. We can modify it any way. We can highlight this talking point or this communication strategy or change the indicators. But it's what are we going to do with it? That's, I think, our collective challenge, you know, among staff and among the board. Think about your agencies. What would it take for the report card to really be a valuable asset where your staff are going out to events and talking to people and they're like, oh, I need to bring 10 copies of that report card because it helps me tell the story and helps me further the work that I'm doing. So, you know, that's the vision that and we hope, too, that it would be something that the public is coming to our board meetings with that report card in hand and going, look, you guys, we have this indicator. You know, we want to talk about this. So how do we put the thing to work? And the Congress is one complement, one tool with this. So just really briefly to remind you of the last Congress happened a year ago this time, so in 2017. It was on the St. Paul campus at the U of M, and there were about 400 people. We filled the place up to capacity, and it filled quite readily to indicate that there was some demand for this event. There was the Congress prior to that had been in 2013, so there had been a few year gap there. And the event was very well received. The folks who filled out an evaluation afterwards, you know, really positive comments overall about their experience there, especially the information that they received and the opportunity to network with folks in their kind of community of environmental change makers. Just a reminder of who was in the audience, kind of a breakdown of folks. You can see a heavy representation from nonprofit and sort of the advocacy community. And also, if you just look at who we were involving in this Congress, it was mostly folks that have a touch point already. They said they're extremely or somewhat familiar with environmental issues. So we are talking a lot to people who, you know this work, have some familiarity about it. So in thinking about the 2019 Congress, I brought together the staff who were involved in planning the last one, and I've also been just having side conversations with folks about how we should put this one together. And here are some of the things the group kind of agreed on and things we know. So we want to build on the momentum of 2017, and again, this point of that the commissioner made about we want to think of this as a cycle so that we come to anticipate, we're looking forward to the next Congress, we're already thinking about it, and anticipate that cycle. We're aiming for February 2019, and, you know, we had a lot of people weigh in on this. It will be after this administrative transition. It's a kind of a tight spot. If you go too late, then people are sucked into session, and it's hard to get people to turn out. If you go too early, then, you know, not all the appointments have been made, so we're hoping February is an okay time to do it. And we're looking at Greater Minnesota for sure, with the last one being in Twin Cities, and we've gotten feedback that St. Cloud is a nice central location to gather a lot of folks. And, of course, it will be tied to the report card. And, you know, just with the timing of this Congress, it is this really unique opportunity for the public to come out and meet new state agency leadership. So how can we really take advantage of that opportunity? Some ideas and questions from the group that I talked to. So one idea is that the Environment and Energy Report Card, whatever form we end up taking it, should be more featured more prominently in the event. In the last Congress, oh, and by the way, I have some programs from the last Congress. I'd love to get these back, but you can pass those around to just remind yourselves of what the last one was. The last one, we had one session that in the afternoon that looked at the report card, but it would be nice if we at least gave everybody who attended the Congress, perhaps in the opening sort of convening, a snapshot of what the report card is and what it's doing. So that was one, I think, really good idea. Given that we'll be in Greater Minnesota, there's an opportunity in this Congress to really highlight innovations that are going on in Greater Minnesota and in the central region. So that's another thing we'd like to do. We had a panel session in the Congress focused on environmental justice, but one feedback we got is that all our sessions should do a better job of integrating environmental justice and equity. And so that's another thing to strive for. And then outcomes. You know, I think one of the learning from last time is what can you really accomplish in a 90-minute session at a Congress with folks coming in with all different sort of experience levels on a topic. It maybe isn't feasible to think you're going to, like, craft you know, a policy agenda in the space of that 90 minutes. But what can you do that is meaningful and does help people better connect around the issues? And what may be new tools we've been using? You know, over the summer, we used Pigeonhole. So are there tools like that or other tools we can use to get input that is meaningful and realistic within the space of that event? Audience, so again, this question around how do we expand the bench and not, can this Congress in 2019 not be the same 400 faces that we saw in 2017? Can it be some different folks, and how do we do that? One opportunity that the group brought up is, can we co-plan sessions with external partners and really try to bring a range of partners on board much earlier in the planning process and have them help drive the content? How can we just simply build a bigger Rolodex of folks that we're talking to? I mean, it was pretty interesting to me. We had across the agencies in the last planning process assemble invite lists of folks that are in their constituencies. But it was interesting how much overlap there are between our agencies. We don't collectively reach out quite as far and as wide as maybe we could. So something to think about. And then early outreach, you know, one thing I'm thinking about, and, you know, if I'm thinking especially of our citizen members have an opportunity, is to just start talking to people now. What would it take for your groups, your constituents, to come out to this Congress? What would you like to see there? And we have the opportunity to integrate those ideas early on. Yes, questions. I'll pause here and love questions and feedback on this.
So if I can just offer just something to think about related back to our earlier conversation around the reporting, maybe it would be helpful. I mean, one of the things that if we want the report to be kind of our guidepost as we do our work here when issues come to the board, but as we go on the community, would it be helpful as you think about structuring the Congress to structure the Congress around these pieces? And that's the format we use. The content within in these areas can move, but that would connect to where are we on the report card, how are we moving those pieces, but then what's happening on the ground from a trend perspective, and how does it relate to these areas that I'm assuming aren't going to change as we move forward. And so something to think about, so that as we build kind of the Congress, then we're able to connect it back to the report card.
Can I ask just a clarifying question? And we did at the last Congress have sessions that kind of touched on those categories. They weren't one for one, but we tried the morning sessions to kind of line up. But one of the dilemmas we face is if we have those, you know, land, air, water, you know, it's how much are we pushing information out to people? Like, come here, what's going on with air?
But if you look at your different groups, if you look at your sessions that you had, mm-hmm. most of the people that you reached out to talk have a specific expertise.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you are thinking about, you know, this you know, for pollinators or something like mm-hmm. that fits under one of these issues, but it's mm-hmm. still a hot and trendy issue.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be, you know, on page 99 of the report card, mm-hmm. this is where we are with chloride in water,
mm-hmm.
but it's related to that specific area. And so you're still able to have that freedom in the type of panels that you have, but you're able to kind of still sneak in there and make that connection
uh-huh.
to the report card and the work that we're doing. And just a recommendation,
yeah.
if that is what you really want to do, is continue to connect to
so each the session card. Kind of features
like,
the report
like
card.
A track.
And, yeah.
Here's
yeah.
a climate track.
Yeah.
Under climate, we can talk about environmental justice. We can talk about all these different things. We can
yeah.
talk about, you know, air quality. We can talk about those things under climate, but that's that track.
Yeah.
And then we can also make sure that there is a session on an update on
yeah.
where are we in the report card with climate track.
Yeah.
Cool. Excuse me, with the climate indicators that are in the report card.
Yeah. Great. Okay. Cool.
What
What's the desired outcome and the perfect audience of the Environmental Congress?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the challenges. I mean, I think if, you know, oh, yeah?
Go ahead, I'll jump in.
Yeah, I mean, I think if one could wave their magic wand, it would be a mix. There'd be a representation of sort of who exists in this state, business, you know, nonprofit, you know, citizens who are concerned. And my hope, why we hold the Congress, this is, you know, other people can chime in, is that folks will feel better connected to the issues at hand, the challenges that we face as a state, as well as the opportunities. So they walk away from the Congress, and they have a better sense, oh my gosh, this is kind of some of the stuff we're up against, and oh, here's some better avenues that I can get involved. I've met somebody that is in my community, or, you know, I've met somebody at state leadership that I now feel like I could reach out to. So that would be sort of what I'd hope for.
Yeah, that's the discretion.
Other thoughts?
Commissioner Stein, you know,
thank you.
I apologize for not recognizing you, but I couldn't see you.
I was hiding.
Yeah, you were.
Yep, I was way back. I think the challenge that we have is to create an audience to that is diverse, that is representative of Minnesota. We do not attract that population. And I'm going to just out the public health folks for a moment. When I went from working at DNR and I could talk to a room full of people at a party, about half of the people, maybe 40% of the people, cared about DNR because they were hunters or anglers or they recreated on water. And I went from that experience to the health department working in environmental health and drinking water, go to a same party and say, I work on behalf of clean drinking water. 100%. People want to talk about that. They want to talk about their health, their family. They have a question about this disease or that disease. Everyone thinks about their health. What we don't have yet is we don't have a meaningful way to engage all people on why the environment does matter to them. So I think we have, and I'm going to just, you know, hearken back to a message from Ed Ellinger that, you know, this is a health, this is first and foremost an economic opportunity for Minnesota. A productive environment is an economic engine. A healthy environment is the foundation of human health. It supports life in all its forms, and we tend to drill down too deep instead of staying at a level that people can engage with us on. So I think we miss in the way we frame our message. Because environment has values. People think it's tree hugging. Some people think that's tree hugging. Some people think it's life essential. So we have to find a different way of framing. And I think the whole frame of an environmental congress is tough for people because it's off-putting to some audiences and it's attractive to the ones that don't need to be there. That's my opinion.
Uh-huh. And just to Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to respond to Brian's question. So the statute that our enabling statute, 116C03, if you go to subdivision 7, it says, at its discretion, the board shall convene an annual Environmental Quality Board Congress, including but not limited to representatives of state, federal, and regional agencies, citizen organizations, associations, industries, colleges, and universities, and private enterprises who are active in or have a major impact on environmental quality. The purpose of the Congress shall be to receive reports and exchange information on progress and activities related to environmental improvement. That was written a long time ago.
Before the internet.
Yeah. So we're thinking more broadly, but that just to give you a sense of kind of where this came from and the name.
Okay, I think we've resolved this issue.
Have we resolved one yet?
Yeah. No, county engineer, I dealt with public involvement on projects many times over the years, and basically when you have a public involvement meeting on a project, those people who are affected, me here now, come, and nobody else comes. So that's not a very representative group. For this Congress, ideally, you'd have 5 million people, you know, the entire population of the state. You can't do that, but you can lever one step up. You've got all these county boards and town boards and city council people that are elected by the people, and they are remarkably close to mm-hmm. what the people are thinking
yeah.
and in communicating with the people. If you can get to those boards, yeah. and there are conduits out there already. They have their own organizations. Say, for instance, the Association of Minnesota Counties mm-hmm. has an annual meeting. If you could get on their general session agenda for presenting the report card, mm-hmm. you could present a lot of information to people that are linked very close to the general public, and you'd get feedback back from those folks. So just a thought.
Yeah, no, that's great. That was something we talked about as a group, too, about how to, you know, look at local government as a great group. We had some local government participation, but I think that could go way up. And my observation, just anecdotally from some of the feedback, is some of the local government folks who participated in the last one were the most inspired and kind of empowered because they had immediate channels that they felt like they could go do stuff with what they learned that day. So that's a great recommendation.
I'm going to step away from protocol a little bit. I already broke the rule. Normally we have a public comment, but please, go ahead.
Hello, I'm Sean Mischewski with the Alliance for Sustainability, and I just want to share that in addition to the report card and the Congress, if you had created a tripod with a more updated climate action plan or, you know, action plan for the state, that would then fill in the gaps between the report card and the Congress would be really helpful. Right now, the Alliance is launching a coalition of 40 of the metro cities that are have signed on to the state carbon goals, and they're saying, dang, this is hard to do. You know, we need to really work together to get it done. So they would love to tie in with state agencies to tackle a lot of the very challenging things they're facing. Also, the environmental groups in Minnesota helped pass the original law in 2007, and we're part of MCAG and CZO, but like there's a lot of changes since the CZO report came out. Like electric vehicles are a lot cheaper. There's the federal investor tax credit that's going away in 2 years, and so there would be a need to revisit the 2025 Energy Action Plan and the CZO Action Plan, and so the I'm also with on the board for the Minnesota REAMP state table, climate table, and we have a deep decarbonization pathways team and have national experts available from like Union of Concerned Scientists and others. So if you're looking at how to like accelerate electric vehicle uptake or how do you deal with rural Minnesota whence electric vehicles are way more prevalent or things like that. So what we need from you guys, number one, would be to understand what are the current interdepartmental teams that are happening. I know you have your mitigation, your adaptation team would like to know what other mitigation-oriented action teams there are. Number two, we could use a lot more collaboration on data access, figuring out how to get funding to the Met Council to help work on the regional indicators data, getting out to all the cities and counties in the metro area track their carbon reductions each year. Number three, we'd like to see building upon the greening your departmental operations you're doing with Department of Admin to help some of those projects related to vehicles and buildings to be spread out to cities and private businesses. And then the fourth one would be looking at how to have, you know, time-limited work teams to build upon and add to the CZO action plan, especially related to transportation, decarbonizing transportation. Cities want to do that, but they don't know what to do. So we'd like to work with the Department of Transportation on that, especially also with rural areas. Once we have autonomous vehicles taking over, the rural people will have to pay a lot for car insurance. It'll be really hard dealing with rural transportation. We also need help on the potentially looking at MPCA adopting the California vehicle emission standards and the zero emission vehicle standards, which would be huge to advance transportation carbon reduction. In the area of energy supply, we need to figure out how together to make sure private businesses use the federal investor tax credit to put up PV solar and using other tools like PACE before that money dries up. That's like free money sitting on the table. And then also on the building area, working on how to enable stretch building codes. And then finally, under the equity area, there's a number of equity impacts in all these areas, you know, related, especially related to transportation. And then on the land use side, there's still a big struggle on preserving farmland in the metro area because of it's just a pain in the neck for these retiring farmers to figure out how to transfer to new farmers that can't afford to buy that much acreage. And so it would be great to meet with Susan Stokes with the Department of Ag and some of the Metro County staff working on ag land preservation. So anyway, thank you.
Thanks.
A couple comments on how you could maybe reach out to more constituencies. Lots of groups are organized. I would think veterans associations, churches. I mean, what about inserting an insert in water bills? I don't know how much that costs. A billboard, public announcements on Channel 2 or whatever channels there are. Communities have tons of local papers that have free calendars where you can advertise this event. You know, and if you, schools, somebody mentioned schools, you know, ask each group you're contacting to send two people to your environmental congress. I think that would be a fantastic way to reach out to the public. Also, on the last environmental congress, I was going to mention, I was there, I was trying to remember, I remember you had a great keynote speaker. So, and I just looked up, I couldn't remember if it was Will Steger or if it was Paul Douglas. It was Paul Douglas. So, you know, that was a very wonderful part about the Congress. But I will say, I went to the breakout session on climate, and I was absolutely shocked because on climate, of course, all the indicators are red, danger, and pointing downward. And at the breakout session, we were told a long time about metrics, you know, how these various things, the minute details about the metrics. And no one addressed the fact that there was an F on the report card, and it was getting worse. And that was my comment when I stood up at that breakout session. It's like we're ignoring the elephant in the room. So the lack of a solution was, any kind of a solution, was just amazing. I mean, when we say pollinators, everyone knows now neonicotinoids, or however you pronounce that complicated word. You know, those two go hand in hand. Pollinator, danger, solution, using less neonicotinoids. But we talk about climate change, and then, yeah, the solution isn't there. And when we mention across several of these, what do you call them, indicators? You know, the solutions, we do know some of the solutions, and reducing fossil fuel use, you know, would help with both health impacts and getting more people on ridership, and would certainly help with climate change. So the lack of solutions in the climate change workshop was just amazing to me, and I stood up and I said, what is going on? You know, so that would be my comment about that. But thank you for listening.
Thanks. I was about to move to the public comment section.
Yeah, I'm going to, Dave, if I could, before you move to the public comment section, I just want to, what's that? No, it's too late. We'll just add it. I want to emphasize, really, because I was going to go to the same place. I think, and I heard what Will read earlier about the kind of statutory language around the Environmental Congress, and obviously we need to be cognizant of that. But I think even within that context, and this is going to sound really trite, but when I go to the gym and there's someone shaving and the water's just running, right? Like, it's a question, am I going to be that guy to say, seriously, you got like 3 gallons of water going down the drain in the 10 minutes you're going to be there? I mean, there are so many, I just feel like the whatever we do here, we're not being inclusive by virtue of the fact we're talking to the people, like John said, that don't really need to be educated. We're talking to the people that know what to do and are probably active on it. And so how do we find a way of communicating more to, and what are the institutions of society that are impactful at getting to quicker and more effective change? And so schools and kids, leverage the kids, I mean, immediately come to mind, but how are we pulling in the stakeholders and the other institutions of our society that could really help drive the cultural change, which will ultimately be the most successful strategy, permanent change, in my opinion.
Thanks, Matt.
Elaine. Thanks, Mr. Chair, thank you.
So I kind of wanted to pull together a couple of the themes that I feel like we've been hearing. Is one is really clearly about the audience for something like the Environmental Congress. And I think it also kind of plays back into some of the comments that we made earlier about the report card. If we're taking, you know, a kind of a more systemic view, is there a way to pull some of these systemic metrics about overall environmental quality and just kind of what I think of as livability for the metro, at least, because that's my worldview, is thinking about some of the things that we look at when you're talking about the trying to make an economic case for high levels of environmental quality and just livability overall, and whether or not we can maybe pull some of these into the review that the greater MSP is doing right now on their overall economic indicators, and trying to kind of raise the platform of what does environmental quality look like for our region. So think about it from that audience and systemic perspective of being able to take the systemic view and pitching that to a broader audience, but then also kind of bringing it down to the decision-making, governance, and kind of policy-making that I think somebody else said earlier of like, so what do I do with it, right? If it's too high level, then I'm overwhelmed by it and I don't know what to do with the information. But if it's kind of somewhere in that sweet spot of like high level enough so that I have a general sense that I can walk out and say, okay, this is not great, but here are some specific things that we can do. Do you want to be the person at the gym like turning off everyone's shower head while they're trying to get ready for work? Or are there other things that we can do as organizations that are kind of more tactical? I feel like I go immediately from the really 30,000 foot level to like, so what do I do about it? And how can I be part of the solution? So I know that was blending a couple of different topics, but.
Thank you. Further comments? Kate?
To wrap up, what I've heard is we need to rethink the report card and have a different kind of messaging. We need to rebrand the Congress, and we have a major audience problem. So blow it all up is what I'm hearing. No. I'm just teasing. No, this is really great ideas, great feedback. I love that you are all engaged in thinking about that. That's what we hoped for today. We wanted to hear all the ideas, and we don't take it personally at all. This is, you know, these are collective projects, and we all have power to shape them. But here's the where the rubber meets
the
road.
Why are you crying?
Well, here's where the rubber meets the road, which is that success of these events is driven by strong agency buy-in, and I would add to that our partnerships. I mean, Eric and I were pretty smart, but we can't get us to all these things that you guys would like to see. We can't get there just the two of us. So the question is, how are we going to work collectively to make these, you know, both projects as successful as possible and prioritize that in the millions of other things that you all have going on in your agencies, in your life? You know, that's the dilemma before us. If we want to do all these wonderful things that you're saying, great, let's do them. We EQB, we're happy to lead the charge, but we need help. So.
Well done. Katie, did you have a impromptu comment you wanted to make?
I hesitate to follow up on Katie's
pile it on.
Yeah, I'll keep it on.
Go for it.
And to give, I want to challenge this idea of like the people who most need to be there won't be there. Are we trying to get behavior change at the individual level, or are we trying to get the collective leadership and impact of people who care about the environment to actually have some power in changing policy and practice as a state? And those are not necessarily the same thing. And I would like to see the people who already care about the environment in Minnesota, yes, join more people in, but also getting more line to actually affect the collective things we need to do together. Because I think we can get down this road of we're speaking to the choir, but the choir is not singing from the same songbook loudly enough in some ways. So how do we use this to help do some of that work? And I think if they're singing from the same songbook more loudly, we then also bring in more people.
Yeah.
So there's a sort of an audience question in there. There's a tension in there, but I think when we kind of not disparage, but sort of dismiss the people who show up at the EQB every month, who come to community meetings, they're essential partners in mm-hmm. this work.
Mm-hmm.
And to see that role and how to help our partners be even more effective, I think, is an important part of this Congress as well. And so I don't want to forget that part of it. It's expanding, but it's also collectively, how do we work better together?
Great.
Okay.
That's a great nuance, and we...
Eric, any comments?
Yeah.
Are we going to try and fit it in?
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you're talking about
The climate.
The deeper dive. Yeah, before we go there, I just want to acknowledge a couple of folks that joined us lately. Lance Yowie. Lance is, stand up, Lance, and be acknowledged. Lance is the former executive director of the Red River Basin Association, went into retirement, flunked retirement, came back to the organization and worked tirelessly to get a new executive director in place. And we have Ted Preister, who leaves a military career and now joins the Red River Basin Association as its new executive director. John Lake Stein and I both serve on the Basin Commission, and we're really pleased to see both of you stick your head in here. Hopefully you can learn something today from this process.
I'll pass it on to Ted.
All right, Ted.
more voices are always valuable, and I hear lots of voices around the table today, so that's a good thing.
Well, thank you for stopping by today, and I didn't want to miss the opportunity to acknowledge your presence today.
And Mr. Chair, for the record, Lance came back because he missed me.
I suspect he did. Yeah. Everyone misses you. Again. Okay. At the risk of alienating a few of you, I would like to go another half hour to 4 o'clock, which is our normal adjournment. And we have with us Kenny Blumenfeld, Todd Bewin, and Andy Holdsworth. And the three are going to come up. Yep. Am I stealing your thunder?
No, it's great.
Okay, we'll come up and give us a little bit of a deeper dive into climate and climate change and what's occurring. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so members, so they're going to come up and they're going to go deeper into the climate section. And that I handed that out in your packets, and then you each have the report card here. Kenny's going to start and talk about climate first. I have a whole thing that I was going to go into, but I think I'm going to just, in the interest of time, pitch it right to Kenny here. This is from our report card, page 27, and you can see that the arrow is red and down, and a lot of this section is red with downtrending arrows or yellow with downtrending arrows. And, you know, Minnesota's climate is changing rapidly with increasing temperatures, and Kenny's going to talk to us about the 2017 data and what's changed since 2017 and what we might see in the 2019 report. Todd Bewin's going to talk about greenhouse gases and what we saw in 2017 there. And Andy Holdsworth is going to talk about wildlife and climate change and what we saw in 2017 and what we've seen since, what's happening at the state level and federal level. So I'll let
early
them.
Early spring or late spring? Kim?
Pass. Thank
welcome.
You, good Mr. Day. Chair, members of the board. Thank you. It's an honor to be here. I'm Kenny Blumenfeld from the State Climatology Office. We are proud part of the DNR. And my job is about one half of it is studying and communicating the science of climate change, the physical science of climate change to the agencies, to DNR units, and to the public. So a lot of the work I do has overlapped pretty heavily and had great partnership with Mark Seely, who many of you know. So it's a similar role, although slightly different audiences for the most part. So the last report card we looked at, I was asked to look at minimum temperatures in the state. And you can see we have a sharp upward trend. Minimum temperatures are just the overnight lows. And we also looked to an extent at extreme rainfall. These are really the two most important changes in Minnesota. So everything that I'm going to share with you, this is a kind of a quick snapshot of our more in-depth climate change presentation that I frequently give. This is all based on peer-reviewed, publicly available information, and it's current. So we really have three key interrelated trends in Minnesota. One is that we're getting warmer and wetter. And then if you want to ask, how is it that we're getting warmer? It's that the cold temperatures are increasing the fastest. And it's really one difference I might advocate for if we go forward with the current climate change indicators would be focusing on winter as opposed to minimum temperatures. Commissioner Stein mentioned, people can actually relate to the loss of winters, and it's actually our fastest changing climate variable in Minnesota. And in fact, I think Andy's going to talk about one of the implications of that. And then the other point that's interrelated to that first one is that extreme rainfall is increasing. So these are the points. We have three other points that we often make that to just give Minnesotans some comfort in things that aren't changing, because often we have to, make the case we're not seeing the sky is falling entirely, but we're not seeing more heat waves by any metric currently. We're not seeing more drought by any metric currently, though those two are actually expected to tick up as we get into the decades ahead. And we don't know what to make of tornadoes, hailstorms, and straight-line wind events, because when we control for population growth, we see no trend whatsoever in the damage being done by those events. And that's a national trend also. And the models, when we look into the future, are a little bit iffy on that. So we're just going to focus on what is changing. And I just want to give you one way of looking at this. This is take all the good temperature measurements around Minnesota, take them back to 1895, and then combine them with all the good precipitation measurements, and you can get an annual temperature and precipitation intersection for a given year. And what we've mapped or plotted these against are the 20th century averages. So any dot in the upper right is a warm and wet year, and a dot in the lower left is a cool and dry year. And you see nice symmetrical distribution here, but I want to caution that that's because I omitted the last 31 years. This took it right up through 1986. If I add the last 31 years, you can see we actually jumped out to the upper right. Minnesota is becoming much warmer and wetter. And even though 2016 was not the warmest on record, that's the horizontal axis, and it wasn't quite the wettest on record, that's the vertical axis, it was the combined warmest and wettest that we had ever observed in the state. So let's talk about how we're getting warmer. It's really being driven by a rapid warming of winter, a loss of cold weather extremes, and fewer of those cold extremes. So just one simple way of looking at this is we can look at the annual trend in temperatures for winter, which we define as December through February, versus summer, which is June through August. And going back to 1895, they both have warmed. Winter warmed at about 0.4 of a degree Fahrenheit per decade, and summer warmed at about 0.13 of a degree Fahrenheit per decade. So winter was warming about three times faster than summer. But since 1970, and we use a 1970 because that's when Minnesota, the region, the country, the continent, and the globe really took off temperature-wise. There's an inflection point where all the warming really kicked in within a couple of years of 1970. Winters warmed at 1.2 degrees Fahrenheit in Minnesota since that time. And if you just compare that to the summer warming, really the fact is winter's warming at more than 10 times faster than summer. It's warming 13 times faster than summer. It's warming faster than we can keep up with. And so the question that came up earlier, how are we doing? All I can say is when I share this information with Minnesotans, often in some sort of adaptation workshop, and I can tell you that we're not ready for the changes that are ongoing, let alone those that are coming. If we just look at a simple graph of wintertime low temperatures, so these are the winter minimum temperatures right through last winter, you can see a nice upward trend of about a half a degree Fahrenheit per decade over the long term, but really look at the most recent few decades. You see a lot of periods, a lot of years where the entire winter, the winter lows were effectively what would have previously been the warmest or very near the warmest on record. So having a near record warm winter is now something we experience every 4 or 5 years. And if we go to one of our stations that has no urban heat island, this is out in Milan, and since we're all Milan, we're all in Minnesota, just and want folks to know it's not Milan. If you go to Milan and call it Milan, you're going to get laughed out of the room. Because it's a wonderful station with three generations of observers, all in the same family. It's rural. It has no urban heat island contamination, which is important. We do see that at the Twin Cities Airport. And they have a very consistent record. So it's really, it's one of the best stations, not just in Minnesota, but in the region. And what we've got here.
Yeah.
Oh, Murdoch. Murdoch is excellent, but they're missing observers.
Yeah, I'm here.
What we've got here is the lowest temperature of each winter in Milan. And on the top, it's the average of those 15 lowest temperatures. And these trends that we're showing here, if you fit it with the linear regression trend line, just this is statistically significant at every level. And the change in the lowest or the coolest temperature of winter is now at about 18 degrees Fahrenheit per decade. In other words, the coldest day of winter is significantly warmer now than it was, you know, two generations ago. And we can look at another way we're experiencing this loss of extremes of cold. So here's our Grand Rapids Forest Research Station, and you can just count the number of negative 35s that have been reported per decade. And look at the way it just drops off. In the last two decades, there have really only been 2 days since 2000 where the temperature hit negative 35, and this is something that used to occur almost annually. And these are changes that we're seeing everywhere. Bear with me. I'm going to ask you to step up your graphical interpretation game for a moment. This is the 10-degree temperature season at Duluth. And what this is when does the average daily temperature first hit 10 degrees during the wintertime? So that think of a high of 20 and a low of 0. And we use Duluth because it's got a good record, and it's also kind of the cultural capital of winter. And it used to be, it's based on 1956 through 1975 data, that the 10-degree temperature season would begin around the new year, just before the new year, and it would end around Valentine's Day. And that the height of that graph just shows you how many degrees below that 10-degree average threshold you would get during the height of winter. You could see several degrees during that period. The next 20 years, we saw roughly the same beginning, and the end moved up by about a week, but we lost that bulky part of winter, that midwinter. And look at the most recent 20 years. That's all that's left. I know, that's the same reaction I get, and you don't think, people in Duluth don't like this graphic very much. So this is actually what's happening to our, this is what's happening to our winter, and this, even though extreme rainfall, which I'll talk about next, even though extreme rainfall exerts a much more direct toll, extreme rainfall is still isolated in nature, and it takes a while before everybody gets more of that. Whereas these warmer winters are affecting everybody on almost an annual basis. You know, we're going to just, even though we've had some cold conditions this year, we're going to keep adding to those graphs because we continue to fail to hit benchmarks that used to be relatively easy to attain. So extreme rainfall, we're seeing increases in the frequency of heavy rain events. So that means how many times we see them. And we're seeing increases in magnitude of them, in other words, how big they are. And then we're also seeing more of these large area extreme or mega rainfall events. And we can, and I'm just going to focus on some basic stuff here. So we have exactly 40 stations in Minnesota that extend back 100 years with reasonably continuous data. So we're just going to look at what's happened in these 40, 100-year stations. So the first thing we're doing on the left is we're just counting the number of one-inch rains each year at those 40 stations. So we're not changing the number of stations over time. And look at, you can just see the nice upward pattern where we went from, you know, between 150 and 200 events at the beginning of the period to now we're up over 250 of those one-inch rainfalls on an annual basis. Over 40 stations. So you add up, so it's all the one-inch rains in, you know, Crookston, Cloquet, and just add them up each year. And then, so not surprisingly, the total rainfall produced by those one-inch rains, one-inch or greater rains, has gone up. But it's not just one-inch rains. That's sort of a baseline for heavy rainfall. It's an arbitrary threshold, but, you know, a one-inch rain is not going to overtop a river under normal conditions. Instead, it'll cancel your picnic or your softball game. But it's, you know, on top of already heavy rains, then you start to see an effect. But two-inch rains are a bit more serious, and those are going up too. And that's the left. And so are the three-inch rains. So are the four-inch rains. In fact, 2016 had more four-inch rainfalls among these 40 stations than any 2 years on record combined. And that's a pretty remarkable feat to accomplish. And if then we just take those 40 stations and we look at the maximum rain, the maximum single amount from any of those 40 stations, you can see that there's really two changes. One is that the values, my laser pointer doesn't work when I point it at the screen. That's an amazing smart screen that we have. So the if you on the left side of the graph, the beginning of the period, the largest rainfall of the year among those 40 stations tended to be between 3 and 5 inches. And you still see, as we get through time, the 3-inch rainfalls are still, you know, they've come up a little bit, the bottom of that distribution, but the top has shot up. So now we see 8-inch rainfalls with a frequency that, you know, we didn't even have one of those 40 stations record an 8-inch rainfall until 1968. And then since that time, especially since 1987, there have been 6 of those. So the largest event of the year is on average getting larger. The number of these heavy rainfall events is getting larger. These are all, by the way, statistically significant and completely consistent with what's in already scientifically peer-reviewed reports like the Midwest chapter of the National Climate Assessment. So this is just localized evidence of what we're seeing. And so contrasted with the wintertime temperatures, extreme rainfall produces pretty obvious effects. And one thing we know is that we expect more of these A-plus rains in Minnesota. This is based on some climate modeling that was done for that Midwest chapter of the climate of the National Climate Assessment. And it basically, don't focus too much on the detail. What it's really telling us is that if you take what had previously been, the top 2 percentile of all rainfall events in the year, and then ask, okay, when we get to about 2040, 2050, how many more or less of those rainfalls will we get? In Minnesota, it amounts to about 1 day. So expect 1 additional day per year. And this is something that only currently happens 1 or 2 times a year. So 1 additional day or, you know, up to a 50% increase in the frequency of these events just over the next couple decades. So that's what I have is sort of a deep dive into the climate data, but I hope that was helpful.
Thanks, Kenny.
Thanks, Kenny. Yeah, thanks. Now we're going to pass it to Todd. He's going to update us on greenhouse gas.
Welcome, Todd.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The role of the MPCA, I'm Todd Bewin with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and the role that we play in this issue is understanding what's happening with greenhouse gas emissions. We track more than any other agency, what is happening with emissions in Minnesota. And that's what I want to talk about today. I have 4 slides. I want to remind you that we have strong greenhouse gas reduction goals in this state. We set, through the Next Generation Energy Act, more than 10 years ago, we set goals for greenhouse gas emissions reductions. And this chart shows you, the lighter gray on the right is showing you our 2015 goal, which represents a 15% reduction from the baseline of 2005. And then the 2025 goal on the far right shows a 30% reduction from that baseline of 2005 emissions. The darker gray represents actual emissions. And so it shows, going back from 1990, it shows a gradual increase, maybe not so gradual. And then since 2005, sort of a bumpy ride down a little bit during the recession, and we've seen some of the benefits of our work on power production and moving away from coal to cleaner and renewable energy sources, but then also a bump up to 2014. And I'm going to move on to the next slide. This is actually the one that's in your in the report card. It's a little busier, so we wanted to start with that first one just to kind of point out where we are relative to the 2015 and 25 goals. They are also shown here in the orange, those two squares for 2015 and 2025. But this is also trying to show you, starting at the bottom with the electrical power, sort of where that's the biggest sector of greenhouse gas emissions. And it has shown some reductions since 2000, 2005, down to the current. Transportation is the next largest sector, and then industrial, residential, and so on. The piece of the pie at the very top, which we're calling emissions avoided, obviously there are many assumptions there about what it would take, what it will take to avoid those emissions. One of the things we're pretty sure about, which is changes in the electrical power grid that have been made and how much of a difference that will make going forward. Let's see. The reduction that we've seen, this is a down and a red, and frankly, we're missing the mark greatly here. We are nowhere near meeting these goals. We have seen about a 4% greenhouse gas reduction between 2005 and 2014, largely driven by the power sector. And I'll talk a little bit about what can we do over the next with the next largest sectors. This gives you a feel for where most of the greenhouse gas emissions are coming from. Electricity generation is the largest piece, followed by transportation, agriculture, industrial, and then residential, commercial, and waste. Again, this is the current state as of a couple years ago, and even while electrical generation has made progress, it's still the largest sector that we need to focus on. Transportation is right there, and it's another important one. And this is another way of looking at that. I think it does a good job of showing the magnitude of each of those sectors. So the blue on the left is electrical generation. The next is transportation. So you can see that by the size of the piece, the magnitude that each of those plays in the total picture. And the second piece to this shows the change over a 10-year period. So that blue piece is showing a nice reduction over a 17% reduction over that 10-year period. Transportation, some improvement there. Pretty flat on agriculture, a 2% reduction over that time. And then industrial, residential, and commercial are increasing and obviously need some attention. A couple of things to be aware of. What's happening at the federal level with our EPA and the federal sort of stance on these things are, the EPA has put together a 5-year strategic plan, and in 2017 we commented pretty extensively on it because we didn't see anything about greenhouse gas emissions or efforts in it. And so that was some strong comments that we made back that was concerning to us. They have just released the report or the strategic plan, and there's absolutely nothing in there about greenhouse gas emissions reductions. Another thing that we're seeing is that they, the Clean Power Plan, which is really focused on power plants and trying to clean up power plants across America, is another thing that's really not moving forward at the federal level at this time. That's been another thing that we've commented on, and we're trying to be sure that the gains that we've made in Minnesota are recognized and continue, but also can be sort of a model for the rest of the country. We have actually, in our strategic plan in Minnesota at the MPCA, have focused on transportation for the next 5 years. The next big sort of sector that we want to work on is how can we take advantage of electrification of the transportation, and because we have made great strides in our electrical production and how we do that in Minnesota, if we can electrify our mobile sources, we will see greater reductions there in greenhouse gases. So I'll leave it there because I want to leave some time for Andy for his piece.
Andy?
Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you. So I'm Andy Holdsworth from the Department of Natural Resources. I'm from our Office of Policy and Planning and really representing some of the work that our agency collects really about the impacts of many stressors, but including climate change on wildlife. And so the short of it is climate is already affecting, you know, our fish, wildlife, and plants in the state. The report really just highlights two species as some examples of that. And they're really important stories to think about. We have seen some significant trends. Some people say this is like, you know, a train that just keeps on rolling. Things are different now, and future climate will be different. And it brings up the question of how do we adapt? How do we kind of buffer and cope with these changes? What species will be able to do that and where? So two examples, Cisco, also known as Tulibee, sometimes Lake Herring and Lake Superior, but we're talking about Cisco and inland lakes. This is a really kind of the canary in the mine shaft for how lakes are changing, whether it's with respect to water quality, but also a warming climate. And so our fishery staff have tracked with Cisco since the 70s, and so we have a lot of data. It's a really important forage fish for important fish like walleye, lake trout, muskies, and pike. The other one, small in the hand, the eastern larch beetle, is a native species. It's a species that's whose behavior has really completely surprised the people who know a lot about it and who manage forests, beginning in the last 16 years. So it inhabits lowland forests, tamarack trees, those beautiful trees. They have little needles, and they turn a beautiful color of gold in the fall, and then they fall down. The most high populations of them up in very northern Minnesota, Coochin County, Lake of the Woods County, for instance. Very important for wildlife, but also really important for forest products, whether that's for pulp or saw timber, but or also for some unique biochemical properties. So first, Cisco. So this is in the yellow and declining since the 70s, when Kenny said we started to see this change in the hockey stick of temperatures pointing upwards. Cisco has been declining, and you see this here in this 20-year record, and this is for the mean catch per net. Cisco exists in about 620 lakes in Minnesota, from St. Cloud and northwards and out from there. So they're declining as temperatures increase. So that's having effects on the fish that feed on them, whether that's walleye or trout or even on pike. So this trend has not changed since the report has come out. This is an example of a trend that's probably not going to change year to year. But what has changed is we have new research that helps us better understand where we could protect Cisco, but also some acceleration of work to try to refocus our strategies to protect those watersheds. Basically, through some really cool science at the Fisheries Research and University of Minnesota, they've understand where the lakes are deep enough to hold on to the cold water that the Cisco need to be able to access as the warming water from the increasing temperatures in the air warms up. And so we have some really cold and clear lakes, clear because they have high water quality and their watersheds are about 75% protected or so. And so they've identified, you know, 176 lakes where even with these warming trends, as Kenny described, assuming that we can maintain good water quality, keep nutrients from running into them, that we could hold on to Cisco, not in those four beautiful range they have now, but in at least, you know, well over 100 lakes. So also there's really great work where in adaptation, our goals will change in some places. We won't be able to always manage for the same species, and that's going to be a difficult change to manage. However, the tools we use can be applied in new areas, and so around those refuge lakes, we can target where we do like private forest stewardship plans with private landowners to help them come up with a sustainable plan for managing their forest. Or we can focus conservation easement funds to acquire lands that are really important to help maintain that higher protected status in a watershed. So this is one species where we have done what species is vulnerable, what strategies will be effective, and how can we apply certain strategies to make sure we hold on to that species that's important as much as we can in the state. So also that means what we measure is a little different. So now EQB has the whole population of lakes shown in that downward trend. But now we're focusing on these refuge lakes. And so this just shows the status of populations through the refuge lakes through the same time period. And if we're successful in our conservation strategies, you know, this line should stay flat. And so that's kind of a new way for us to kind of measure how well we are doing in protecting those refuge lakes. Okay, large beetle, really close. This is, so Kenny showed the Grand Rapids weather station, you know, 8 to 9 days below negative 35, you know, per year in 2000, maybe two since then. So in 2001, the larch beetle is a native species that is considered largely benign to people who are concerned about forest pests. And when it has an outbreak, like you see there in those larch trees, those brown areas, those would only last maybe 3 to 4, maybe 6 years. Now you can see basically in the last 16 years, these are the acres with larch beetle mortality. It's just been increasing. If we add 2016 to this, there were 73,000 acres that had larch beetle mortality. So that means about a quarter of our 1.25 million acres of larch or tamarack in the estate has been either damaged or killed by larch beetle. So what's the big change in their biology is they used to reproduce once a year. Now they can reproduce twice a year. And so that's allowed their populations to grow beyond the natural causes that would keep them in check before. So this is an example, you know, really this is an area where we need to do more research. There's still the question, how well can we regenerate tamarack in these stands? And what's the current condition with these stands? So there's a lot we need to learn here to see to what degree can we improve our management practices to retain kind of tamarack as an important habitat and just part of our forest ecosystem. So that's all I had.
What happened in 13? With the, you know, spiking,
right.
Dropping, was it a cold winter? I can't remember that far back.
Yeah, beginning the winter of 2012-13 ended very late. So it would have affected presumably could have affected the regeneration cycle, whereas the 15-16 winter was quite warm.
Okay. Questions or comments for Kenny or Todd or Andy? Seeing none?
Thank you all very much.
Out of the park again. So thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Is there additional public comment make at this time?
So they don't need this room then?
Thank you.
No, they're not going to switch over now.
With that, I believe a motion to adjourn is in order. So there is a motion. Is there a second?
Okay. Yeah, put it back together.
Say aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. We stand adjourned.
Oh, yeah.